Rocking, episode number 20 of the Inside Running Podcast. Thanks for joining us again. This show's brought to you by runnerstribe.com. Thanks to Runners Tribe for all their support. Always the best place to get content, anything distance running in the world, I'd say. How are you, Brad? How are you, Julian?
Good, Brady.
Ticking along, mate.
Yeah, that's good. Everyone's ticking along. You boys would hit up Runners Tribe a bit, wouldn't you, during work? Just read the articles during the week?
Yeah, I do always have a look, and noticed an article today on Dennis Cometto having a run in Vienna, I think.
He's back.
So, yeah.
Yeah, good. Julian, you'd spend half your hours at the shop on Runner's Tribe, I reckon.
After hours at Runner's Tribe.
After hours, yeah.
That's an extracurricular activity.
Nothing better than sitting down Jared Clifford's columns. You've been reading those ones?
Yeah, he's talented.
Man, he can write, can't he? And he can run. We'll get to him a bit later on, but he's only like 18. He can put some words on a page, that boy.
Yeah, he's good.
I think I read somewhere on Twitter this week that they should actually, should be his turn in the spotlight after his weekend. So, yeah, might be good to see if that appears on runnerstribe.com. But, yeah, thanks to those guys again for putting our notes on their website, our summary every week. We really appreciate that help there. Now, Julian, just in your conversation there, you sound a bit off. Everything all right at your end?
I'm just coming back from some gastro I had on Monday evening. So not in the best of health, if you put it that way.
You have already sent the message through to Brad to tell him he's got a lift this week.
Yeah, no, I'm not on game tonight. Don't roll me up.
We appreciate you here with us. We'll start with you, though. Talk us through last week, because you had the big run for the kids race on the weekend.
I did. I ran on Sunday morning, was run for the kids. So I pretty much had a standard race week training for me, which includes kind of loading the front half of the week, I guess. So that allows me to still get a good week of mileage but not do too much towards the race. So I ran just a 10-miler with an 8K, so 16 and 8 on Monday. I'm trying to hit the hills for my 16Kers, make the most out of them. Then on Tuesday I did a workout along the Steve Monteiti track around the lake, where I did 8x K with 60 seconds. I wanted these to be progressively weighted, where I start slower and get faster, which I think is good for race week stuff because it means that you don't go out and absolutely smash yourself in a workout and you finish confident. But I ended up maybe the wind wasn't friendly, so the first one, two were okay, had a bit of a headwind, so that was good to help slow them down. So I went 3:07, 3:07, and then I had a bit of a tailwind where I went 3:04, 3:01, 3 minute, and then the headwind at the end, which kind of put me in a position where I wanted to keep them progressive, but it was getting harder and harder. So 3:03, 3:02, and 3 minutes to finish. When really, like, that was probably a little too hard of an effort than I wanted at the end, because it was a pretty strong wind, and you know the lake in Ballarat, like, that is a windy place at the best of times. So, but I was happy to get that done.
That surface isn't fast either, is it? Compared to a road, like, you're slipping around a bit.
Yeah, the gravel's shit, especially in summer. Like, I think Bree said it hasn't rained here properly for 6 weeks or something, I reckon she said. And once that gets dry and once that gravel gets super loose and dry, yeah, a lot of people get, like, hamstring issues on it because they're constantly slipping underneath when they're taking off. So you're kind of stressing your hammy a little more. But, yeah, that was a good session. I was happy with that. So that was Tuesday. Wednesday got out for just another hilly 15K with a second run club. Thursday I went and did 10 by a minute hard, minute easy, which is what I like to do before a race on the weekend. That was just as part of a normal run. Up to Melbourne for Thursday evening for a meeting on Friday morning. Ran with Big Chris, who owns our Clifton Hill store, on Friday at Studley Park, kind of the Melbourne Trails, which is it's a hidden secret Studley Park area. It's just it's like a labyrinth of little single track and gravel path, hills in there, golf courses, and you wouldn't even know you're in Melbourne. So if you're a Melbourne runner and you're not getting there, then it's a bit of a waste, unless you live like on the outskirts. But if you live in the city, Richmond, kind of Collingwood, Fitzroy, South Melbourne even, you'd get up there as much as you could, I reckon.
Have you read the comments on this on Strava, Brad?
No, I've just opened it up now, actually.
I said it last week, but I'm going to do this more often. Just check your Strava a week after when the comments start appearing and like the titles go up. And this is on City Life with Big Christoph. Nick Earl's getting into you. A few listeners are in their territory.
Yeah. No, Nick Earl, we'll get to Nick Earl. Anyway.
Some good comments in there. Yeah.
Yeah. So Saturday, went out for a jog before work. Yeah, that was fine. That was nice. Had a good playlist on. Got myself some wireless headphones, so take my phone now on the run, which is nice because I get to listen to Spotify, not my regular playlist. And then on Sunday, Run for the Kids. So it was with Run for the Kids, it's always interesting. Like, you rock up on the morning and you don't really know who's running it until that morning. So everyone's looking around in the start line going, who's here, who's not here? Is there anyone that's going to go out fast? And I was sort of looking around and, like, obviously Liam's there, Liam Adams, so, Liam will win. And then who else? Who's going to come second and third and fourth? And there wasn't a great deal of names, like, that I thought that could beat me. I thought I'd be all right there. Like, I thought I could challenge maybe for a second or third spot. But so the way the race played out, from the gun, it was very fast the first few kilometres. So it normally is there because it's a downhill kilometre and you get caught up a little bit from the gun. There's always people on the sideline and you're running downhill. So you go, oh, let's get after it. And you know, like, once you get out of the tunnel, there's going to be a really exposed section. And the exposed section, you need a pack to go well with. So you kind of want to be next to someone or with people there. So if you have to work harder early, then it almost pays off later. So our first few Ks, if I have a look, first K was 2:52. Then the next K was 2:46. However,
yeah, that's in the tunnel though, isn't it?
That was in the tunnel, yeah. It does say it's in the tunnel, which is not normally right. And you can see that it's just a full straight line. So that wouldn't be right, I don't think. But I know that first few K felt really fast. I'd say if the first one was 2:52, the next one would have been around 2:50 as well, because it felt just as quick.
So you've gone through the first 3K in just over 8:30, which is...
I don't think it was that fast. Like, I think the third K was slower than that because the tunnels kind of messed it up. Because if you have a look at the Strava map, like, it just shows a straight direct line. Like, it loses GPS, which is why it shows the course is shorter rather than longer. So I reckon it was probably like, I think I got to the 5K split and it was like 15:20. I think I lapped it at 5K, so... oh no! Yeah. So, 15:35. It said. Okay. But anyway, it felt fast early, and the group kind of got away from me. And then it was quite funny as we came out of the tunnel. I could see the front group just basically stop running and just start jogging, and that was made up of Liam, Nick Earl, and another African fella called... I've never seen him before, actually. I don't know where he came from. What was his name? Anyone know?
Abiri Kass K-A-S-S-W.
Yeah, okay. So have you guys run into Abiri before?
No, never seen him.
No, so he was in the front group, and you don't know if this dude's like a 205 marathoner or what, but he was running next to Liam and Nick, and they were just basically, they weren't even running 4 minute Ks, I don't reckon. And it was, funnily enough, like obviously Liam and Nick are worried about what's going on behind, whether there's a group coming up or not. And so they saw me back there, and Liam actually got to the back of the front group and started like waving his arm to get me up to the group. So he was like giving me the whole come on signal, and he was just laughing. He thought it was comical, and I was like, oh, I've got to go now. And so I got up to their group and then stayed with the group. It was really quite odd, like how no one was running hard at that point. Then the African guy sort of surged a little bit, and Liam covered it, and Nick and I just sort of hung back. And then we went into a group again. And then at about, I reckon, about the 6K mark, Liam just went bang and just basically sprinted for 400 metres and put in a gap. That Abiri fella, he went with him, and then Nick and I stayed together. We probably picked it up a little bit there, but we didn't go with that front break. Then up the Balti, it was Nick and I were together. He was sitting on me at that stage, like probably about 500 metres into it. And he does this thing where he exaggerates how bad he's feeling, like I don't know what's going on. Like he sits right behind me and he starts like heaving in my ear. And I'm thinking, yeah, I know, like, you're kidding yourself, Nick. Like, we know, I've run with you enough times to know this is not stressing you out, this pace. And so he got to the Balti, and then he just went around and went up, and he sort of dropped me up the Balti. It was at this point where I was thinking, oh, like, this is the race. Why, you got to go with this. You got to go faster. But I was just feeling a bit heavy and a bit... it was almost like I wasn't motivated to really hurt during the race. It was a little bit of a depressing feeling, really, at the end. I thought, I just watched the race go, like, go away from me. But I was... at the time, I couldn't do any further to stay with him. And he eventually caught second place. He caught the African, finished second to Liam, who won convincingly.
He's a 208 and guy, the African. 208, 18, he? Yeah. Dubai, 2014, 61.07 half marathon in France in 2013. He's only a young blood as well. He's 1994, he was born.
No, he looked 50.
Wow, I just copied and pasted his name straight from the results into Google. And, date of birth, 8th of December, 1994. Hasn't run anything on the IAAF website since 2014, though. He's made $18,000 worth of prize money in his career. I don't know why. You keep talking. Interesting. I'll keep researching.
Okay. I ended up, there was no one behind me, and I was never going to catch any in front, so it was about a 7K grind to the finish at that point, where I was pretty happy for the race to be over. So the top three, obviously Liam, Nick and Abiri. I was fourth. In the ladies' race, pretty cool, Charlotte Wilson, Liam's partner, she won the race. I think this is the second time that they've taken out that partner double, and I think Brady's going to get an interview with those guys later in the week.
Yeah, later in the week.
Is that confirmed?
Yeah, that's confirmed. It'll be on next week's show.
Excellent. Cool. That'll be good to hear. And Charlotte will be able to tell you how the ladies' race went down. Tali Bird finished second, and Camila Wishaw was third in the race. It's a good event. Always fun, well organised, nice course. Like, it's a fun course to run. Conditions were pretty rough on everyone this year. It was windy. It was kind of humid early. And it just got worse during the run. But everyone's got the same, so you can't really complain about that.
Did you give Nick Earl any lip across when you got to the finish line? No lip for sitting on you?
No lip. Like, he's beaten me so many times. He's a better runner than I am, and like, he's got better PBs than I do. He beats me convincingly every time we run. I've got a lot of respect for how the guy can continue to race, because even I was out there and we're on the top of the Balti and I'm thinking, I just don't have it in me today. But he always seems to have it in him to get going and to perform well in nearly every race that he does. It's actually quite impressive that he can back up that often.
He must
really like the attention of doing well.
It's a hard guy to beat. Hard guy to beat. Brad, talk us through your week. Back feeling good? Quads are all right?
Yeah, body's all right. Not too much to report. I ran 90 kilometres, made up mainly of anywhere between sort of 45 and 60 minutes. I guess the probably two highlights for me were Monday was a public holiday, so teed up a run with Chris Hamer, which was pretty cool because he's, I think, now headed off to Noosa for a bit of, I guess, heat training before comp games. So it was good to catch up with him. So that was just sort of 45 minutes. And then just ran an hour on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And it's pretty unmotivating, like, at the moment, just because I'm not running with much purpose other than to just not lose too much fitness. But I don't want to get back into things too quickly either. So, yeah, so Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, just an hour. We had our athletics carnival Friday, so it was a pretty early start, and we had a few drinks after work, so I didn't bother running Friday. Got out for... Oh, and then the other highlight of the week was meeting Benny Walker, guy that plays the music at the start of our podcast. So he was up in Canberra for a gig and met him down at the lake. He was doing a bit of a progressive tempo. Ran with him and paced him around, which was enjoyable. And then went to his gig Saturday afternoon. So it was really a great guy. So really, really enjoyed spending some time with him. And then Sunday was a very hot and windy 90 minutes, and I actually really struggled on that run. So I ran like 22K and, I was just, I think maybe that was the sign where I hadn't fully recovered from the marathon. So just the heat in the hills just got to me. And when I hit stop on my watch, I was pretty happy to have finished that run. It wasn't very enjoyable. So that was my week. So not much to report, really.
That's good. How'd you go pacing Benny for his session, all right? Didn't take him out too hard too early?
No, it was funny just how much you rely on Garmin. So we started the session, and for the first 600 metres of the first kilometre, so I didn't have K-splits on, but he was getting like 4:20s and I was getting 4 minutes. So I was pretty confident that my Garmin was right, but he was looking down going, oh, I'm running 4:20s and I'm meant to be running like 4:10s. So he sped up, which I guess then, because he was running 4 minute Ks, probably went out a little bit too hard. But after that, he was, it was fine. So, he's moved along pretty well.
He's in good shape. You didn't rock up in your Fox hoodie and stuff, did you? I told you to dress sensible. He's a pretty fashionable guy.
No. Yeah, so I guess running clothes is okay. You can get away. You don't have to be too fashionable.
True. And, at the gig, though, you would have struggled, wouldn't you?
Yeah, rocking up to his gig, I'm like, fool, yeah, he's at a complete... No, he's probably up three levels above me when it comes to that sort of stuff. So he's good-looking man.
Yeah. Good-looking. Good. Some good music as well. Some good music.
Oh, yeah.
We've got his live track really actually leading into this TV interview this week, so they'll get to hear where that track comes from and, hear the stripped-back version of it.
Yeah, I've actually got to hit him up and get him to send up a CD just so, we can have it in the car. So I have to email him about that.
Yeah, you can organise that. Good work.
Yeah.
My week was pretty good, 195K in the end. Just did a lot of, I think I took a leaf out of your book, Julian, when you said, did you say on last week's show you're trying to do 8K in the morning and then 16K in the afternoon pretty much every day?
That's what I'm going for, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I like that. I did two sessions, but I just tried to do a stack of jogging and not really focus too much on overall Ks and then just see what it come out for. at the end of the week. So, yeah, public holiday Monday was nice because I could go out in the middle of the day, or not the middle of the day, but, yeah, wasn't stressed to get up too early. So I think I hit, 16K in the morning, then 8K in the afternoon. Tuesday, I did a session, 6x1K, and it was, massively windy day up here as well, and I did them out at the industrial estate where it's kind of like a horseshoe, kind of a U shape, and I was running kind of the first 500 metres of each rep in a minute 40, and then the second half in like a minute 28, so just one of those ones that you couldn't run fast in the wind, and then always had to recover in the tailwind because it was so strong. But terrible session for me, average 308s for 6x1K with a minute recovery, but not too fast. Like, first session back, I usually need one of those to blow the cobwebs out. Got to the gym Tuesday, arvo, and had a session in there, which is good. Didn't pull up too sore from it, which was positive. Wednesday morning, got out for 7K in the morning and then 90 minutes in the afternoon. Want to try to really get that medium long run back happening on a Wednesday of 90 minutes. Thursday, 8K in the morning, 16K in the afternoon, so no, I only wanted to do two sessions this week, so didn't do a session Thursday. Friday, 8K in the morning, then I did a 10K tempo in the afternoon, so I just worked on heart rate around about 160 beats, and just focused on the heart rate and didn't look at the pace, and ended up averaging 320 pace and 161 beats per minute, so that was positive, because I think one of my 1K reps on Tuesday was in 315. I thought, geez, I'm out of shape running a 315K, but it was good to see by Friday that I'd rolled around and could average 320 for 10K without too much hassle. Jogged through Saturday morning on some nice trails. It was 36 degrees up here on Saturday, so I had to get out pretty early and did 21K on this nice single kind of single trail that we've got up here that I hardly ever run on, but every time I run there, I always tell myself I've got to get there more often, and kind of early in the morning, it was beautiful to be running on that one along the river. And then Sunday, went back to Bendigo, ran with the boys, Jamie the Beast Cook and Andy Buchanan, and got 2 hours 10 out, so added 10 minutes on last week, which was 30.3K. Averaged a bit quicker this week, 4.17s, but it's probably the same amount of effort as last week. So that was good with the boys again. Jamie didn't do 3 hours this week, he just did 35K. Out for a easy 8K in the afternoon, which brought me to 195, which I was happy with. So kind of progressed last week. I said I wanted to do two sessions. Did two gyms this week. Went to the gym after the long run on Sunday when I got back to town. And, feeling all good at this end, like I'm starting to gain a bit of fitness.
Have you got any longer races planned in the near future?
Maybe, we'll see. Just kind of... I want to get that Sunday out. Like, I want to get that Sunday at probably... I remember Sean saying, like, he was doing 2.5 every Sunday. He said that, didn't he?
He said 30 to 35 every Sunday.
Yeah. I reckon there's something in that, like, always just being at, like, 30 to 35 every Sunday. I don't. I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet. I'm still writing off March. I'm just going to run... Like, next week's the last week of school, so if I can hit another big week this week and a big week next week, then I can kind of add a bit of quality. Had some good sessions early in this week, like it's Wednesday when we're recording, and had a nice session yesterday, so feel like the legs are coming back around and want to put myself in a position where I'm fit and then can choose whatever's going to happen.
I only say that because, I guess, looking at your last few weeks, like, you've increased your mileage pretty rapidly from what you're doing.
Yeah, it went from 150 to 190.
And I guess 195 is pretty high if you're not sort of in, like, if you don't have a marathon coming up.
Yeah.
But, that's just my observation.
No, I'm not like you, mate. I'm not signing deals to go to marathons anytime soon. All good. I'm all good. We'll get to that news a bit later on. No, I'm not. I'm just trying to hit mileage, and that just happened to be that big. But it's not... It's a bit misleading. Like, I said to a couple of people that I ran 195K, but when, like, it was only 16 of that was good quality. The rest of it's just jogging along, and it's quite easy to hit 195K for the week if you're not doing big sessions. You guys agree?
I actually find those weeks harder.
Do you? Yeah.
because you're just out there, like, I don't know, just jogging around. I get bored doing that. Mm. So I find those weeks hard.
What do you think, Moose?
Yeah, you need a good playlist if you're going to do that. You also need some good trails to run on or some motivation to get out there, a good group maybe.
Don't have any of those things.
Yeah. Well, you've got to find some, because 1 week of it you might get away with, but for me, I need something after, if I'm doing that for 8 weeks in a row. But I like that you're doing something different, and by different I mean, I guess it's more mileage, but I would have liked for you to come back and maybe aimed at a shorter, like to do, I guess this is me, my thought, is to do what I did when I came back from a marathon or a good one and felt good. I thought, oh, let's get faster and then get stronger again.
Oh, do some track stuff, you mean?
Awesome. It doesn't have to be track stuff. It could be faster stuff, like cross country or whatever.
I'm definitely thinking in that direction more than marathon stuff. I don't think I'll do a marathon till Berlin.
You're doing workouts like 3x3K and everything, and that's not what I mean by fast stuff.
Yeah, you mean like 10x400, that kind of stuff.
Oh, I mean like 200s. I mean like getting faster. You're not going to lose aerobic capacity if you're still running 180, 190K a week, but you're not going to gain the efficiency stuff, like the faster top end stuff by doing that, which is what I think you might need.
Yeah, one thing I was thinking, I was making sure I was doing plenty of strides and stuff at the end of those runs last week, because I find you get a bit stale. Like the quickest pace I was kind of running was 308s, and the majority of the fast stuff was at 320s. So you kind of got to expose yourself to that 245 kind of pace.
That is good. That's the smart way to do it too. Well, that's like if you're going to run a lot, you need to do it to do what you're doing.
I'm doing a speed session tomorrow night with this young kid. He 8:55 at Nationals the other week for the 3K. He's going to towel me up, but I think I'm putting myself in that situation for that reason to get smashed. I think we're doing 200s and 300s and stuff. I don't know what his coach has teed up, but I'm just jumping in to help him out and hang on for as long as possible. So yeah, it should be good fun.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. Brad, Sydney Grand Prix. Did you watch the live stream?
Yeah, I watched a few of the events. So I guess we'll start off maybe with the men's 1500. So Matt Centrowitz was out from the US, so the Olympic gold medalist in that event. So he won the race in 3:37, but it was a hot field from the Aussies. Like Risley finished second and James Hansen third, both in 3:38. And then like I know Josh Johnson's a Canberra boy. He broke 3:40. So there's a lot of guys running between that 3:38 and I guess 3:45, which brings me to Michael Roger and Jared Clifford. They both ran 3:45. Jared just beat Rogues, but they both broke their respective world records in their class. So that was phenomenal running. So did you boys watch it?
Yeah.
No, I didn't get a chance.
I only watched it on replay. I didn't watch it live. I think I pulled over on my drive on the way to Bendigo to do that long run, and it was over before I could get my phone sorted. But Jared Clifford though, he had like four races in 3 days or something like that, and that was like his last opportunity to qualify for the world champs.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Won the Australian National Under 20 1500 meter the day before, 2 days before.
Yeah, but obviously hadn't run the qualifying time, even though he won the title. And then, as you said, it was his last opportunity. So, and it was like it was a 3 second PB, wasn't it?
Yeah, 3:45. Yeah.
Huge. Yeah, it was great.
I heard good things about Central Week as well. People were saying he was spending a lot of time with them and kind of really up for a chat, and good to be around.
Yeah, I heard that as well. So just in a couple of the other sort of distance events, so women's 3K was won convincingly by Lyndon Hall. She ran 8:53, and from about, a kilometre in, she pretty much just cleared out. It was daylight second. Men's 3K was pretty close. Joel Tobin-White won the race in 8:06. James Nipperis was second in 8:07, and Kev Batt was 8:08. So I hadn't seen much of Kev Batt this summer, so it was good to see him back on the track. Men's 800, Dylan Stenson won in 1:47.16. So I think I heard him interviewed after the race, and he's not far off the South Australian 800 meter record. So I think that's what he's sort of chasing for next season. So that was Yeah, that was Sydney Grand Prix, I guess, from the distance point of view.
Yeah. The other half-decent event on this weekend was New York City Half. Any of you boys watch it or just got results here?
I watched it on I recorded it on Fox on the Sunday night and watched it on the Monday.
Pretty close race by the look of it.
Yeah, it was. Like, it wasn't an overly exciting race to watch. I sort of got a little bit bored, but, yeah, did you want to run through the results?
Yeah, Ben True, 62.39. Dathan Ritzenhine, 62.43. And Chris Thompson, 62.43. So, Ritz was 42. So, yeah, what, 4 seconds separating the first three guys. Pretty rare to not see an African in that top three as well.
Yeah, it was. And, like, I think Thompson was well, and like, it was pretty much down the straight. It was between Ben True and Ritzenhine. It was just that Thompson came late, but he was never really a chance, even though it, you know, shows that he's only 1 second behind Ritzenhine. So, I think it was pretty tough conditions as well, because that course changed this year. So they started over in Brooklyn and ran over into Manhattan. So we can't even really compare it to other years. And it was quite windy, I believe. So the women's race was won by DeRaba, 72.23. Emily Sisson was second in 72.24. And a Norwegian girl, Grovdal, was third in 72.43.
Yeah, good for Norway.
Christian will be happy.
Christian from Norway will be happy. I've got to come down to Ballarat and start looking at a few houses for him in the next couple of weeks, Julian. Start going to some auctions and stuff. He's moving in with you, I think.
No room here. Cedric owns a spare room. Vince has the other one.
Loosen the question. This is a good one. Who wants to read it out? I'll read it out, boys.
All right. I'll do it. Jesus. I'm nearly dying here, but I'll read it out. From Dr. Liam Johnson. Okay. How do you guys mentally prepare yourself for a race? And secondly, what mental strategies do you guys use within a race to get you through the tough times? For context, in last week's episode, Julian mentioned he was fairly sprinting during his 5K race, and it got me thinking, if that was me, I would be like, stuff this is too hard. So what do you guys think about during the race to overcome the negative thoughts or to drive you when you're feeling right at your limits or past them? That is a good question.
That's a very good question.
Both are good questions here. So he's got two here. The first one, how do you guys mentally prepare yourself for a race?
Brad?
I guess I often look back through my training. So I guess I get a lot of confidence. And I think I've said this in previous podcasts. If I've ticked all the boxes in training and I've hit key sessions, that gives me a lot of confidence mentally to go into races, knowing that I can actually do it. So that's, I guess, how I would prepare mentally is just, having good preparation. And I guess that's what all the training's for. So that you can actually stand on the start line and know that you've done everything you possibly can. And I guess, lead up to Lake Biwa, I was pretty disciplined with everything that I was doing in terms of nutrition, maintenance on my body, sacrificing sort of, a bit of a social life. But I think when you make those, and I remember Mona saying this to me actually over in Berlin, that like he used to obviously not drinking things like that in the lead up to the race, because he used to like getting on the start line knowing that he'd done absolutely everything he possibly could to race the best he could. So, a long-winded response, but probably just confidence in the training that I've been doing.
Mm. Yeah, I do the same. I often flick through back on Strava or my training diary and kind of just look at all the sessions that kind of give you confidence going forward on the race, because it's really, racing isn't too much new. Like, you want to go to that next level, but there should be things in training that can show you that you're capable of doing that on race day. And it's a very simple sport. Like, yeah, put one leg in front of the other as fast as you possibly can and swing your arms as fast as they can go as well. So it's kind of just almost dumbing it down a bit, that you know you can do, a certain percentage of the race at the pace you want to run it at, because training indicates that. And just going out there and doing it. So I guess that's, I stand on the start line with confidence, knowing that my training's been done and I'm ready to race. What about you, Julian?
Yeah, I think mentally preparing is all about being confident. So you can't be negative during your lead up, that's for sure. I guess reminding yourself of good days that you've had during the build up and also good races you've had in the past, that plays a part. So I think everyone sort of has the same idea, just trying to relax more. Like, I don't think it works for many people to really build it up as like a significant ground, like, I mean, game-changing event. I think that just builds pressure and tension. And most people perform better when they relax a little. But not everyone's the same, so everyone's a bit different. I tend to perform better when, like, I know it's important to me, but I am confident going in. So trying to get that in my head in the weeks leading up is quite good.
You go in pretty serious, though, don't you? In the races, yeah.
It works for me to go in serious in some races, I think. Like, the really important ones, I think it almost like the mental strat, like the second part of the question starts to come play out a bit earlier in those races. So like, how do you guys overcome the negative thoughts? It's almost like it starts very early, almost in the warm up, like where you're getting yourself really in the zone, which is what I do to overcome what happens during the event. So those, like, I guess to be more clear, when I'm in the longer races, I think it's a different kind of mental strategy you use to the short races. So the 5K that Liam asked about, where I said it was sprinting, well, I was actually, like, the mental strategy I used there was thinking, you've done sessions that indicate you can run pretty close to this quick, so you can do it. Like, physically, you can do this. Don't worry about if it feels too fast. Your sessions tell you you can do it. And so I kind of just tried to hold on. And then I just kept thinking, it's not long to go, not long to go. And just stay on the... And so that's a different sort of strategy than what I use for if I'm in a marathon and I'm 25, 30K in when it's starting to feel hard. What I think about there is more... It's probably... comes back to a more like emotional type of strategy where I start to think about more like personal stuff or significant stuff that allows you to overcome hurt a little better. So that's what I would think about, like maybe thoughts about people that have made sacrifices for you in the past, sacrifices you've made or other people that are thinking about you when you're running. So that can really affect how my mental state is, and I think I can draw on more strength when I do that.
Yeah, I think as well, I think during the actual race, it depends how important that race is to you as well. If it's not an important race and it starts to hurt, you're probably more likely to go, yeah, stuff this. But if it's something that means a lot to you and you have actually put a lot into it, into preparing for that one, you can always fight through probably a bit more. Two other things, I guess, for the longer races are just try and, like, distract yourself. Or, like, a good thing about a marathon is there's generally a drink station every 5K, or, like, BWA every sort of 2.5K there was something, because you'd have the drink station, then you'd have a sponge station 2.5Ks later. So it almost like just takes your mind off it. But also, like, when you're fighting through pain, I think for whatever race you're doing, you can only fight for so long. And I think pacing comes down to a lot of it. So ideally, in every race, you're going to hurt. But if you've paced it right, there shouldn't be a massive amount of pain for a really long period of time if you've done it right. So I think that's really important as well. Because if you run through the half marathon way faster than you're capable of, then it doesn't matter how tough you are or what mental strategy is, that second half's going to be hell, just because you haven't paced it right. So there are a couple of others.
Yeah. The other thing I do as well, and you guys have kind of touched on this, is almost try to distract yourself. I know when I was doing some big sessions leading into Berlin Marathon, the guy who was pacing me on the bike had, I think he had a website or something on the back of his singlet, and I was sitting behind the bike and I'd almost in my mind play around with the different letters on the back of his singlet with the website and see how many different words I could make and kind of just distract myself that way and almost get myself into a bit of a trance. And then, yeah, just kind of just disassociate running for a while. You're still running pace and sitting on the back of the wheel, but you're not really thinking about the pain of it. You're kind of distracting your mind. And then I remember in Steigen 10K as well, Julian, like trying to hang on to your back and just cutting myself's deal. So we might have been like 7 laps to go and saying, all right, you're starting to struggle here, but just pretend there's 1 lap to go. Just keep in touch. So kind of cut myself a deal to stay every lap, and then you get that lap done, and then you're like, all right, just 1 more lap. You've only got to stick through this guy 1 more lap. And then all of a sudden it's down to 2 or 3 laps to go and you've got dropped. But, yeah, just trying to cut yourself a deal and just distract the brain a bit and break things up a bit, which is kind of what you mean, Brad, with the drink station, just getting to the next one.
Yeah, and also I think for the marathon, I know a lot of the old school marathoners don't love those, you know, 25 to 30K of close to marathon type work. But for me, that was a way of me actually practicing my mental toughness, because I felt like that was what was lacking the most for me becoming a marathoner. Was most of my sessions as a track runner are 25, 30 minutes, and it's like, well, how do I get comfortable just zoning out at a pace for like, you know, an hour and a half to 2 hours? So I think I got a lot of benefit from doing those type of sessions in the lead up to a marathon, which a lot of old school marathoners would disagree, like, you know, don't do.
Yeah, so put yourself in a situation where you're going to, be in on race day.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Julian,
they call it.
Julian said that in another podcast I listened to him on this afternoon, that same thing, like you're preparing mentally as much as physically with those bigger sessions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Yeah, good. That's a great question.
I haven't listened to that yet.
Yeah, I'll talk a bit about that later on, Brad. That's a great question from Liam, though. You can see why as a doctor we've kind of asked smart questions like that rolling in. Hey, Rundy's competition winners, Grant Simpson and Jack Maxwell. Thanks for your entries for that competition last week. Couple of pairs of Rundy's coming to you boys. We'll hit you up on Instagram and get your addresses. Not sure if you boys seen him, but Grant Simpson was on a run at Point Lonsdale, just up to the lighthouse there. Nice and scenic location. And Jack Maxwell was running over the Sydney Harbour Bridge when he took a selfie when he was listening to the podcast. So thanks for that, fellas. Really appreciate you boys joining in there. Julian, next segment's for you. Bit of a shoe chat.
Yes.
Is this Moose on the Loose or shoe chat? Shoe chat.
All right. What are your questions? Ask me some questions.
Yeah, well, Sean Helmet messaged us on the Facebook page, and Sean's a good bloke, Midday Miler in Melbourne, listens to the show every week, and he brought to my attention that Adidas have released a sub-2-hour shoe. But the marketing behind it seems non-existent, and yeah, kind of really hard to find any information on it. And it's out. You can buy it online off adidas.com.au, but comparing that to kind of the Vaporfly launch and how that took the world by storm and how you're sold out of them everywhere kind of thing, it's quite strange. What do you know?
Well, given that I'm in the shoe game, I kind of knew they were bringing one out. I don't have an Adidas account, which means I don't sell their shoes in the store, but I knew they were bringing one out, and obviously this kind of shoe grabbed my interest. I had an idea what it was. It was like a new little tweak on their already existing foam called Boost, and they were trying to tweak it to make it somehow sub two. However, all they did was make it lighter. They doesn't seem like they've made any significant change to the shoe at all, except make it lighter, but they've called it a sub two shoe. Probably because they chucked it on Wilson Kipsung, who is most likely to go sub two for the Adidas guys. So he wore it at Tokyo last year, actually, like a year ago, he was wearing it in a light blue, like a baby blue. It was actually a really nice looking color. So it's taken a year to go from someone running in it there to get released, over a year actually. And yeah, I was like, although we don't even sell the shoe, I thought I'm going to get it anyway, like I'm going to see what it's about, I'm going to do a few runs in it, just assess it. And tried to find it on Adidas's website. This was in the probably the month leading up. I was checking every so often to see if there was any info on it, and not a single mention, not a new release, not an upcoming release or anything. So I was just assuming, Australia wouldn't get the shoe. Then I called Adidas on its release day and said, are you getting the Adidas sub too? And the guy goes, oh, is that one of those Pharrell Williams ones? And in my head, I'm like, oh, this is why I survive. This is why I have a job, because you guys are so shit at what you do. And so he didn't know. The other Adidas store didn't have a clue. He sort of said, oh, maybe they'll be at the other store. And that was the one that I just called. They were literally Adidas employees working in footwear that had no idea that this shoe existed. And to me, that is a problem. Like, really, your job is to know about shoes. You don't even have to know about any Nike shoes or Brooks, Saucony, Puma, but you should know about the fucking shoes you're selling or not selling if they're from that brand. So I was pretty, I was actually quite relieved to hear that, to know that they're still terrible at their job. So yeah, I went online. I did see it was still not on the Australian site until later on. I didn't buy any, basically. I would have, but they made it too hard. Yeah. Then the next one was, or the next, well, wait, is that okay? Do you understand now what it is? It's basically like a lightweight racing flat.
Do you reckon, because Kip saying pull, because so he wore them in Berlin as well and pulled out, and then he would have won New York. No, it came second in New York in them and then pulled out Tokyo. Like, do you reckon they've pulled the publicity on it because he hasn't performed?
Nah, no way. No.
Just not into promoting it. Do you think, are they just piggybacking on the Vaporfly?
No, they came up with this idea, I reckon, around the same time. Like, I reckon they both kind of had this, like desire to go sub two. And they both had the idea for a concept behind a shoe. It's just Nike actually used some innovation, and Adidas did not.
And they basically made it. Like, they put on the event to try and do it in the shoe.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Adidas, I think, just they've just tweaked one of their existing models. That's kind of what it looks like.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. So you're not going to buy one?
I would. If it was convenient for me, I would. Yeah. But when I went online, they only had size 11 to Australia anyway, so no, I won't. I won't risk it, actually. Not for a shoe that... Not if they're that bad at their job in Australia. They don't deserve my money.
Customer service, that's a key.
It is.
And it's not that baby blue anymore, is it? It's that black colour now.
Oh, I love the blue, though. I would be all out the blue. But what I would... like. This is why local running stores exist. Go in and have a chat. Talk about it with people that are in the industry and love the industry. Like, that's their passion. Go and talk to them. They can tell you about it, whether it be worth getting or not.
Yeah. Well, on the Vaporfly, Brad, that leads into, you got a bit of a lip for wearing the Vaporflies in Lake Biwa this week. Do you want to talk about that, or we can move on?
Yeah, so I was just chatting to, he's actually a good mate of mine, from Sydney, and he's a bit of an old school type runner, and he congratulated on me run. He goes, tell me something, did you wear those Vaporflies? And I was like, yeah. And there was just like this tone that it was almost like, well, you only ran well because you wore those shoes. And like, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but as I said to him, well, unfortunately you don't get to run that same race in, you know, two different pairs of shoes. You only get that one opportunity to run that race, and you've got to choose a pair of shoes. And, so it sort of, after the conversation, it sort of just made me feel a bit, I don't know, a bit down and sort of doubt whether, you know, whether it was the shoes or whether it wasn't the shoes. And, I guess...
So how about this?
Yeah.
This same guy, right, does he go up to the next guy that finished behind you and say, oh, did you wear racing flats for that? Oh, well, you know, they're more efficient than wearing a training shoe. Or did you wear shoes? Oh, that's more efficient wearing shoes than barefoot. Like, yeah, how far do we go with this? A performance advantage from wearing shoes, full stop, and then by wearing racing flats, you're more efficient than wearing trainers. It's like, this is just another racing flat that's more designed for a marathon.
Yeah, like, I get that, and I look at, okay, like, Kipchoge almost broke 2 hours in them, but outside of that, like, I quickly brought up after chatting, thinking, you know what, if these shoes were so good, he would have run way faster in Berlin. He ran 2:03:32. In 2013, he ran 2:04:05 in Berlin, and then in 2015, he ran 2:04 flat. So, you know what I mean? It's like, if these shoes were amazing and making massive differences, then then he would be running close to 2 hours every time he put them on.
But you're forgetting Berlin was about a minute slower last year, though.
and I guess the 2 minutes, other thing is, I was thinking back to myself, and it's like, well, I didn't do a lot of training in those shoes, but my training that I was doing in other shoes wasn't far off what I was racing at. You know what I mean? So, I think where he was getting at was that people that are sponsored by other companies, and I'm sure there's examples of this where if you're sponsored by ASICS, for example, like say I was sponsored by ASICS at the moment, I'd be bitter that I don't have a shoe like Nike have out at the moment. Like, so I think what he's saying is that he'd like to see the playing field, I guess, even. So, well, I guess if Nike have a shoe like that, ASICS should have a shoe like that, and I guess that's up to ASICS to do that. But
if you go and look at the top five at the Ironman New Zealand, the one they had over there a few weeks ago, there's footwear sponsored runners that were wearing Nike Vaporflies that were not Nike sponsored that have footwear sponsors. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah, wouldn't you be the same though, Moose? Like, if you were sponsored by ASICS, and you'd probably want to run in a pair of the Nikes.
Oh, respect the company supporting you, mate. It's all about all about loyalty.
Yeah. So.
Nah, I know what you mean. I'm sure. Like, I have a choice of all shoes to wear, and that's what I'm picking at the moment.
Yeah, and that's one advantage of not being sponsored. Hey.
Just
so many advantages.
Anyway, so that was just an interesting conversation.
That annoyed me though, because like, if you check your Strava for the last 15 weeks before that race, it kind of, I don't know, it takes a bit of the credibility away from all the hard work you're putting in.
So
I was ready to smash that guy.
Thanks, mate.
When you sent it through to me, I'm like, what are you talking about? So that was good. Another bit of news, boys. You read that article on Mo Farah on the weekend?
I did.
Took me a while to get through it. It's a long one.
It was long. It was informative, though. Yeah. Plenty of facts in there.
It's a good article. I'm not smart enough to go into it.
Yeah, we can't comment on it. I'm just saying it's a good article. We might put it in the show notes or on the Facebook page because it's got some informative information in it.
It was great to read that. I love reading it. And I don't know enough. Like, it's so hard to comment on this stuff because you just don't know. Yeah. Like, I'm sure there's people that know, and we just don't know. Well, it's worth a read.
That's why it was so good, because he kind of didn't throw any allegations out there. It just stated facts the whole way through. I did read somewhere on Twitter, someone shared it and just said, this journalist has balls or something like that, like very ballsy article or something like that, just the way it was presented.
Well, we got ticked off on by a few solicitors before it went up, maybe.
I think
a few lawyers.
Moose on the loose. You got something?
Adidas. Done. Ticked off.
Ticked off. All right.
Adidas employee store.
Glue in your shoes. World half marathons this weekend. A few notable absentees in the Australian team, boys. You notice those names off the start list?
Yeah.
Australian team, from five to three.
Yeah. I kind of knew Robinson wasn't there. And what was it, Harry Summers?
Yeah.
He raced on the weekend.
Did he?
Yeah, he raced in the Vic 16K trail race.
Surely.
Came fifth, my sources tell me. I'm looking it up at the moment. Yeah, I didn't see the results, but yeah, Big V Trail Series. You keep talking about the other boys, Collis, Dijon, and Tom DeCano.
Yeah, well, I've seen Collis running fairly regularly, some Saturday sessions. It's always a bit tough to tell because the sessions kind of blend into runs, and I don't see him for half of it because he's well in front of me anyway. But and I don't know, I've never run with him before when he's been like at his peak or anything, so I don't really know what this sort of what his sessions translate to very well. But he's certainly like been fitter than he has. I don't think anyone's disputing that. He works a lot now, like every single day, so or close to. So he's still, but he's still trying to train through that. But you're not. I don't think you can be as confident going in when you're having so much work behind you and not as much running. And he's sort of coming off the Achilles injury. But it's Collis. He is pretty, he's like, I'd say he'd be in our top 3 to 5 of all time distance runners. Would we say that?
Yeah. I would, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's no medals like the older boys. Like, when I say older, like the Herb Elliotts and stuff, but the time is amazing. The times that he's run are amazing. And so when you look at someone who's run 27:30 was it that he's run? Around 27:30, 13:08 off the top of my head.
Yeah.
You got a bloke who can run a very fast half. So I don't. It would be no good. I'm not even gonna predict the time there. And then you've got DJ and Gebrselassie, who is a very unpredictable racer, who could come out and run incredibly well, or he could run 75 minutes. And then Thomas DeCanto, who is probably the exact opposite of that, who is very consistent, smart racer, strong, and he's also on the up, but on a more progressive or a more conservative progression than what DJ is. So in the females, we've got Ali and Pashley, and we've got Sinead Diver, who is very well performed over marathon and half marathon distance. Millie Clark looks to be withdrawn for some reason we don't know. And so, yeah, Sinead is obviously like has experience on a world championship level. She knows this sort of atmosphere, and she's a very good runner, obviously. I think she's run 72 minutes before, maybe even faster. Again, I should look at this stuff. Right, Ali's coming off like a bout of anemia, and she's getting stronger each session. She's had some really good confidence building sessions. So I think she can run around 72 minutes as well. And that probably won't like get her in the top 20 or anything, but still having that field around might even get her a faster time than that.
Yeah, pretty good experience for her.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, that's good. That's when is it, Saturday or Sunday? You boys know?
It's Saturday. Yeah, Saturday their time, so it might be like might be late on Saturday night here.
It's Saturday 5 PM for them.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. So that's gonna be well into Sunday then.
Yep. Yeah, I don't know how it translates. We'll have to look at that.
Yeah. I'm really excited to see how the guys go, because like the three guys are all coming at it from different points in their career, I guess. Like, you know, Collis is, you know, as you said, he's not probably at his best, but he's always really consistent and has had a really long career. DeCano, you know, hasn't really had a blinding half marathon yet, but probably has the potential there based on his marathon. And Dijon has, you know, like if he's on his best day, he can run like super quick. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how what order those boys finish. Any predictions on the finish order?
I'm going to predict Collis, DeCanto, then DJ.
Yeah, I'll go with that as well. you are the wise man. Who am I to go against the wise man?
Stick with the wise man. Leads us into the next part of the news. You can hear the wise man on the Hidden Athlete podcast. I had to listen to it today on my run. Quite entertaining. You listen to it, Brad?
Not yet. No, look forward to it, though.
Oh, maybe yeah.
This weekend.
Tell you what. It's all the stories you've heard before. Just they go for about 15 minutes longer than usual.
And isn't the Hidden Athlete about these, like, low-key guys that, you know, no one ever knows about?
Yeah, I read their bio. It's like, yeah, humbled athletes that don't get any media or something. Like, Julian bangs on about himself every week on a podcast.
Yeah.
They've got the wrong bloke.
I think it's just blokes that haven't reached their potential yet. That's what it's about.
Oh, yeah. I'm waiting for Monty Getty to tap him on the shoulder and just tell him to pull his head in a bit down there, I reckon, Brad. He starts to talk like he's a 205 guy in this interview.
I can't wait to hear it.
Nah, don't.
Dude, that is foul. That is not even.
The host of Ross and Blake, they do a great job, though. Blake pulls in some good segues from a podcasting point of view. He's got a future in the game. He was keeping things interesting. Yeah, he was keeping things good. But yeah, we'll put links up to that in the show notes as well. It's all the stuff you'd imagine, though, Brad. Navy stories, Bogan Hotham, like recount of like every kilometre. Then, yeah. And he starts banging on about Berlin, throws me under the bus in there at one stage, says how much I was struggling at 33K. Man, good boy. Well,
you're not arguing.
I've got a video on Instagram. We're side by side and we look just as good next to each other. It's what happened after that.
I was basically like feeding you the bottle. That's how done you were.
Mate, I gave you my bottle because you missed your drink.
You couldn't get it down anymore.
Yeah, it was an entertaining interview. You'll enjoy that, Brad. What else is coming up? What's on this week?
Yeah.
Let's get going.
What's coming up? Nah, I've got to run more. I've had a day off. And then today I ran 6K. It's like, I might as well retire after this.
Hang up the socks. You're done.
That's what it feels like. Tomorrow I'm going to run 50K, I reckon, just to make up for it.
Brad, can you share your news about your next marathon?
No, I don't even know my next marathon yet. But I do plan on doing something at the Gold Coast.
Hooters?
What's that?
Go to Hooters?
Yeah, maybe. Contemplating doing the pace job again. Just because I had such a good time last year. I'm still a couple of weeks away from getting back into full training. Got school camp next week, but I might do a light session tomorrow. And then I guess sit down with my coach and try and work out a bit of a plan. But I'm probably going to do a bit of shorter stuff between now and July. So maybe a few 10Ks. Another couple of weeks of no real structure.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, same here. I'm just getting some training done. Go to Bendigo on the weekend and run some hills again, I think. But that's it. Thanks for tuning in for another show. Stick around because the Trevor Vincent extended live interview is coming up next. And enjoy that one. And thanks again, Bradley and Julian.
Yeah, thank you.
See you next week.
See you, boys. Yeah, I'm going to talk about that in a second. Welcome, guys. Thanks for coming around. This is the first one for the Inside Running podcast that we're doing a live interview. So really appreciate your attendance here tonight. I wasn't sure how many people were going to take up a free ticket, but it's great to see some absolute legends in the audience here, TV. We've got some of the big names of Echuca Moama in attendance. So it's really good they're here tonight. Before we do start, I will just explain what a podcast is because a few people might not know, but a podcast is pretty much an internet radio show. So every week on the Inside Running podcast, we record a show with my co-host Julian Spence out of Ballarat and Bradley Croker out of Canberra. And we talk a bit of rubbish about running each week. We talk about our own running and then we sometimes review some gear. Sometimes we talk about running news. And then we interview a guest every week. And you're going to be our guest for 2 weeks' time, TV, which should be good. We're still recording you, Benny? Yeah, we're good? Sorry. Yeah, you'll be our guest in a couple of weeks' time. So all these guys are getting an exclusive listen to what's going to go out to about 5,000 people download the show every week from all over the world. And, yeah, we're pretty happy with how it's going at the moment and really happy that we can do a live show and, yeah, get the listeners involved in one capacity or the other. So I'm looking forward to spend the evening with you. Before we start, though, people that don't know, Benny Walker, sitting over here, is not just organising all the audio tonight. We also use one of his tracks, Undercover of My Skin, for our intro and outro music. And he's going to treat us tonight and play a live version of that song, a bit of a strip back version. So we appreciate that he gives us permission to use this song each week. And we appreciate that he was here at lunchtime today setting up all these chords because I'd like to think I'm half good at talking about running stuff, but coming to setting up this recording gear, I don't really have much of an idea. But before we start, Benny's a proud Yorta Yorta man, and we're on Yorta Yorta land here tonight. Always is, always will be. And I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. And yeah, really just say thanks to Benny for taking some time out to set up this stuff and give us a bit of a show tonight. Over to you, Benny. Before I start, do you actually want to explain to the people here and the listeners hear this song every week but might not have any idea about the meaning behind this song?
Sure, I'll use your mic because this one's got reverb on it and it's going to sound like I'm talking in the Grand Canyon. So basically this song came about when I was in the studio with the producer of the latest EP I've done. He came up with a chord structure that you'll hear very shortly. And I thought it was really cool, and I'd been writing the week before at home, but on the guitar, same key, this kind of bluesy thing, and the lyrics, the lyric content is me reflecting on the experiences I've had growing up as an Aboriginal person with lighter coloured skin, and some of the very uncomfortable situations I've been found myself in. Through other people's ignorance, basically. And, you know, I might be meeting someone for the first time or might be someone I've known for a little longer than that, and then something completely disgusting will come out of their mouth, and I've got to then take a deep breath, compose myself, and have a conversation with them that neither of us wants to have about why what they've just said is very hurtful or completely unacceptable. And, yeah, upon reflection, it's just I've just learned how far I've come, I guess, in the way I deal with it. As a younger man full of testosterone, I used to handle things a little bit differently, and I've learned to use my words since. So I found it's a far more effective way to handle the situation. And anyway, this song's called Undercover of My Skin.
Just kicking, bringing so much pain. Oh, I hear you say,
Thanks, Benny. That's your mic now. Okay. Hard act to follow.
Yeah, I'm not going to sing.
So, TV, I'm going to read this introduction only because I don't want to miss anything, okay? But, ladies and gentlemen, the guest we got tonight, Trevor Vincent, also known as TV, is best known for winning the 1962 3,000-metre steeplechase at the Commonwealth Games that were held at Perth. He won that race by 2 seconds and ran a Commonwealth Games record at the time. His longtime mate and training partner, the great Ron Clark, described TV's performance in winning as one of the finest athletic efforts he had ever seen. In Ron Clark's book, The Unforgiving Minute, he talks of TV as an aggressive and courageous runner with a turn of speed. It would be very unlikely to hear or read any running story from the 1960s in Australia that didn't mention your name. Here's Glenn Huntley Training Group train at Caulfield Racecourse most evenings after work, where they would run a steady 10 miles, often barefoot, gradually increasing the pace to a solid effort. The group had a huge zest for racing and would race all distances from the mile to the marathon. This era of running in Australia really shaped the foundations for our future greats, the De Castellas, the Monoghettis, the Mottrams, just to name a few. And TV had a tremendous influence on this. TV also ran at the 1962 Olympics, 1964 Olympics, because it was the 1962 Commonwealth Games, Brady. He won 20 Victorian titles. He won 4 Australian championships. He's received an Order of Australia and an Australian Sports Medal. His PB for the 3K steeplechase was 8 minutes and 39 seconds, which was a national record at the time, and also ranked him top 10 in the world. And his personal best for the mile is 4 minutes and 1 second. He's also been a manager of the Australian cross-country team before. Today, some 50 years later, TV is still heavily involved in his beloved Glen Huntly Athletics Club, and he's often seen at all the cross-country races in Victoria as a team manager and a mentor for the Glen Huntly Athletics Club. He still spends every Christmas holidays at Falls Creek, overlooking the altitude training up there in the group sessions and sharing his knowledge with other people. His knowledge of running history is amazing, and he has collected some incredible memorabilia along the way, including personal letters to him from the great Emil Zatopek. Thanks for spending some time with me tonight, TV, the live audience and the listeners of the Inside Running Podcast, and welcome.
Thank you.
You got to talk into the mic.
Thank you.
That's the biggest introduction we've ever done for any of the guests on the podcast.
Well, I won't correct the few minor mistakes you made there.
I'll have to blame my researcher there. Tell us, what are you doing in Echuca Hammer to start off?
Sorry?
What are you doing in Echuca Hammer?
Well, I've actually got some links to the area. My wife's family came from Pyramid Hill, and she was born there, so we're going down there for the day tomorrow. Not many people know Pyramid Hill, but I've actually run a few races there, the Pyramid Hill Fun Run. And so I know Pyramid very well, but also on my mother's side, I've got ancestors came from Deniliquin, so I know Deniliquin very well, and the other area nearby is Bendigo, and in my earlier days I ran many times in Bendigo, including quite a few times in the Eagle Hawk to Bendigo fun run.
Fun run. Did you win that back in the day?
Yeah, I did once.
It would have been hard to win back then, the Eagle Hawk to Bendigo, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, the year I did win it, usually if anyone knows the Eagle Hawk to Bendigo road race, you get to the top of the hill at what's called the American Hotel. It was British and American.
British and American Hotel, yep.
Just first to the top there usually won it, because it was all downhill from there. And the year I won it, I beat Graham Crouch. And I got to the top about 10 metres ahead of him, so I thought, I'm right here, but I've just managed to hang on. The other times, other guys that have won at Bendigo, Eagle Hawk to Bendigo, are Bill Scott and, you know, a whole range of top athletes. So it is a prized event. I've never raced at Echuca, but maybe one day.
Yeah, sweat versus steam every October. I think it's October, September maybe. Laurie's the run director from Sweat versus Steam, October. We'll have to get you up here this time next year.
Oh, yeah. No, I'll be in a new age group then, so it might be worth giving it a go.
Might be an easy win.
Yeah. I don't think anyone else in the age group.
What about the Pyramid Hill fun run? Like, that blows my mind, knowing Pyramid Hill now, that it had a fun run back in the day. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, they had a weekend. It was called the Pyramid Hill Ironman, and they used to climb up the hill. You can't run up it. Now, Tarly's been there, but I don't think you can run up it. Can you, Tarly? No, you can't run up it. But it used to go out in the back blocks and then finish just in the at the base of the hill. Wasn't huge prize money, but and there wasn't much opposition. But I did have opposition the time that times I ran. Bruce Petz from Bendigo was a pretty handy runner, and he seemed to be. It's a bit later in my career, but Petzy seemed to handle me pretty well. So there's been a couple of good winners at Pyramid Hill, but it doesn't happen anymore.
No, you must have seen a lot of fun runs over the years, or not? Were they fun runs back then, or were they like significant races on the calendar?
Oh, in the early days, there were no fun runs. No, we just had state championships and inter-club competition, but no fun runs at all that I can remember from those early days. They used to have sort of meets down at places like Yallourn. In the early days, we used to have a team that competed in the Yallourn Relay, so it was 1 mile legs, and it was just round the Yallourn city centre. And I was the first person to break 5 minutes around the circuit, but I only did it by about 5 minutes because I made sure I was a team manager. I ran leg one, and no one had broken 5 minutes, and I ran 4:59, and then Ron Clark came on about leg three and ran 4:56. So I made sure I beat him to it, but not by much.
Take me back to the Start TV. When I was doing a bit of research, it was interesting to read that you didn't start running until a few, I guess, you know, a bit of a later time in your life at 16, 17 when you're finishing up high school.
Yeah, that's right. Well, no one ran much in those days. And so, you know, if someone went out, occasionally in my early days when I'd run from home, I'd get people saying, making comments like, "Who do you think you are, John Landy?" You know, but it was very rare to do that sort of thing. And in my last year, or no, year 11 at high school, I ran in the school sports and I won the mile, which I'd never done any distance running. So, and then I later on the same year, I ran in the scout sports. I was in the scouts at Caulfield Racecourse, and a couple of guys from Glen Huntley Club saw me there and talked me into coming over. So that was when I was probably about 16, 17. And I came over then and started running in those days, which was just pre-Olympic Games, pre-Melbourne Olympic Games. And the Melbourne Olympics were an incredible time. It was just great in timing for me because it's just so inspiring. Prior to Melbourne 56, and I'd only just started running, there was some incredible running happening here. An Australian athlete who not many would know now, but broke the world record, Dave Stevens. Dave ran a world record for 6 miles at Olympic Park, and then around, oh, that was a little bit after, prior to that, in late 1955, a group of Hungarian athletes came out here, and they were world record holders, and they raced Dave at Olympic Park. And the first race, they cleaned him up, and the next two races, Dave actually blew them both away, blew the three of them away. And then early in 1956, Dave went on to win break the world record for 6 miles, and he broke Zatopek's world record for 6 miles, so he wasn't a bad runner. And so I got to know Dave, and he was one of the inspirations in my early days of my running.
How were you being inspired? So was this just going to watch him at Olympic Park, or was it in mainstream media or on the TV and the news bulletins every night? Or
no TV.
Where were you getting the exposure from?
First time I saw television was at the time of the 56 Olympics. And we didn't have a television set, so I watched some of the Olympics in the window of a shop. But I actually went to the track a few times because in those early days, 54, 55, even a bit before, when I was a young teenager, it was the time of the first sub-4-minute mile, or the attempt on the 4-minute mile, and we see Roger Bannister just passed away a few days ago, which was very sad. But the Australian who was chasing it was John Landy, and so I saw John run here and run 4:02 for the mile a couple of times, and one of the other things that got me inspired to see Landy there and follow the progress of that 4-minute mile. Landy and Bannister were the first to break it, and the third person to break it was a Hungarian named Laszlo Tabori, and he was one of the ones that came out here and raced Dave Stevens in late 1955. And on Facebook, just the last day or so, I saw a tribute from Tabori for Bannister. So he just praised Bannister for all the good he'd done and talked a little bit about the influence he'd had on him. But he was the third person to break 4 minutes for the mile. And Tabori's still going strong. He came out and competed in the 56 Olympics for Hungary and never went back, and he finished up in the USA, and where he still is. And Tabori, I met him in 2006 when there was a celebration here, 50th anniversary of the 1956 Olympics. Tabori came out for that. And, yeah, so he's still around, and so is John Landy. I'm happy to talk about Landy a bit later too. So I've had a lot to do with John.
It sounds like such a age where you're impressionable, and there was just so many things that could motivate you to train and get involved in that athletic world at the time.
Yeah, well, that's right. I was very lucky, as I say, seeing Landy and then Dave Stevens break the world record, and then moving into the 56 Olympics and being aware and having a good Australian presence there, because in the 56 Olympics we had a third place in the 10,000 metres, Alan Lawrence. And then for the two subsequent Olympics, we also got bronze medals with Dave Power in 1960 and then Ron Clark in 64. So 1956 was quite... And I mentioned to you before we started, I think, that as a young guy, I went along to the 56 Olympics, and a couple of my idols there were Betty Cuthbert, who won the 100, 200 double and a relay, three gold medals, and Dawn Fraser, who was an incredible swimmer and won three consecutive Olympic gold medals at 100 metres. So I was well aware of those, and watching them as a spectator, little did I think that they were still around in 1964 when I made the team. So I've happened to, then 8 years later, I was on the same team as Betty Cuthbert and Dawn Fraser. So it's amazing the way things turn out. But it was, had an incredible influence there. And John Landy was a great person who I've got to know over the years and still keep in touch with. And I won a few Victorian Mile Championships, five actually in succession. And most years when the winners' medals were presented, John did it. So it was great to have John Landy so involved.
He still does it now, doesn't he? Did he present it 2 years ago at Melbourne University?
Yeah, he did. For a while they dropped the Victorian 1 mile championship, and the Australians dropped because they've moved to metric. But fortunately, the mile still happens. They have a Victorian, but I don't think they have an Australian anymore. I must say I'm a fan of the mile, and you'd find lots of others are, because 3 3/4 laps of the track just seems quite weird to go around and race 3 3/4 laps of the track. But in the old days, Edwin Flack, who I wouldn't mind talking about in a minute, in 1896, Edwin Flack won the 1,500 metres in 1896 in Athens, and that was I'm pretty sure that was a 500 metre track, so they had three laps of the track. But, so I'm a bit of a fan of the mile, and, of course, that mile of the century and the race with Landy and Bannister, the first 4 minutes, and then their clash in Vancouver in 1954. That's rated lots of mentions in the last few days and lots of films because, as I say, Bannister passed away just in the last few days. He's the same age as John Landy's 87. Bannister was 88, so, and John's still okay. But sadly, Bannister's gone, but a few others who are in that race are still around. Bill Bailey from New Zealand is still going strong.
And talk me through just the attention on that first sub. Like, I've read books on it, and probably doesn't do it justice unless you were there at the time. That first, you know, sub 4 minute mile, just touching on Landy now, was it just huge news and everyone knew about it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was incredibly huge news. We were hoping that John would do it, and he'd been, been very close several times. Sometime before he actually broke 4 minutes, Bannister, even in that 4 minute, world record race, he was paced in that. Well, some may argue he wasn't, but he was paced by the other two English guys. Maybe a month or a few weeks before that, they also paced him, but fortunately he missed out, and I think that he actually acknowledges that, you know, it wouldn't have been fair if that one had been a sub 4 minutes, because what they did in that one, they had still the same guys, Chris Chataway and Chris Brasher, and Brasher later went on to win a gold medal in Melbourne in the 56 Olympics in the steeplechase anyhow, but they actually had one of them run the first lap, and then he stopped and waited until they came round the end of the second lap, and he hopped in and paced him then, and they had a very artificial pacing effort, and Bannister missed out. He still ran pretty quick. But then when they actually did it at Oxford in May, it wasn't quite as paced, but it was still paced. They both, I'm not sure both Chataway and Brasher finished, but, they paced him.
Were people pacing Landy, though, like at the same time, like in Australia?
No, not really. But John never had any pacing. If you'd watch races of John's, he'd get out and lead nearly all the time because he'd get out. He's a bit like Ron Clark. John, and a bit like Steve Prefontaine, I suppose. They really wanted to get the best out of themselves. A bit different to me. I like to win races. And so you use a range of tactics, but you always pretty well knew with Ron Clark and Steve Prefontaine and John Landy that if you're in a race with them, you're going to have to earn the spot. And very rarely did those guys get beaten, but when they did, it was a surprise. And it's just a one-off for a lot of them. When Clarkie was beaten in Tokyo, Billy Mills beat him in the 10K, and no one had ever heard of Billy before, but he still lives on that. I see they had a Billy Mills day in somewhere in the US just this week. So some state declared it Billy Mills Day.
TV, you're doing a great job of dropping every other name by yourself here and shifting the attention to you. So I want to know, how do you go from an impressionable kind of young kid who's looking up to all these people to also finding yourself on the Commonwealth Games team and Olympic teams with them, and also getting pretty close to that 4-minute mile? So how did it progress for you to get to the same level?
Well, I suppose I was fairly lucky. I had that experience then, and then I started to improve a bit. The only time I ever raced, I can't say I raced, but I was in the same race as Herb Elliott, who was only a few months older than me. But he retired before I started to even run really at my best. But I ran in a 3-mile race down at Mornington. I think Herb won it in about 14:20, 3 miles, not 5K. And I finished about 6th or 7th. So that was the only time I raced Herb. But I think I just got a bit of a feel that I had some ability there. And then what happened, I tried the steeplechase, and you mentioned that I won the steeple in Perth. That was the first time the steeple had been held at the Commonwealth Games, so there was
good
no
timing.
Record.
really? Yes, yeah, yes. Okay.
Yeah, you mentioned that I'd broken the Commonwealth Games steeplechase record, but actually
it was... Don't tell people that, TV. Yeah. Just go with it.
I've got to be honest. I didn't break anything. I think there might have been a Commonwealth Games steeplechase in about 1930, but it was 2 mile or a mile and a half or something like that. And anyhow, I started to run a little bit better and got second in the 1958 or 59 Australian Steeplechase Championship, and that was the first ever Australian Steeplechase Championship. There'd never been held an Australian championship had never been held before. Even though we had three representatives in 1956, there was no Australian championship held, and they couldn't really. I was going to talk about this later, but Melbourne and Sydney were the only two places that had a water jump. So I competed in the 90, quite a few Australian championships. I won the mile championship of Australia in 1961 in Brisbane, but the steeple was held in Sydney a month later because they had no water jump in Brisbane. That happened in a few other places that you had to run the steeple in a different state. So a steeple wasn't a high priority then, but I knew of Ron Clark, who'd broken the world record for the junior world record for the mile. And late, around 1960, Ron decided to make a comeback. He'd been playing football, but fortunately for athletics and maybe unfortunately for football, he had an accident where he broke his finger. Forget which one, but he broke his finger and it wasn't successful, but they had to have another operation. And when they did the second operation, they gave him the choice. He either had to have his finger bent or straight, but he couldn't move it. So it was bent, and he always, if you shook hands with Ron Clark and it was his right hand, you'd always wonder what was going on there because his finger was bent. But because of that, he couldn't play football anymore, so he decided to make a comeback to running. And a mutual friend, Les Perry, who was a famous Australian distance runner in the 50s, brought Les over to Caulfield Racecourse, where I was training with a mate of mine, Tony Cook. and Ron joined us in late 1960. And we both, well, things went on from there. We trained as a group. We had another few others involved with us. Rod Bonella, who was a great marathon runner and third in the Commonwealth Games in 1962, and quite a few others. And there were some athletes from earlier days training at Caulfield. John Landy had trained there, but before my time. Dave Stevens made his comeback around 1960, so we knew a lot of those people, and we decided, we just started running on the race course. And then prior to that, prior to 1960, a friend of ours who sort of, well, it was our mentor more, a guy named Frank McMahon. Frank used to run with us at Caulfield Racecourse. Then he discovered Fernie Creek, the forest at Fernie Creek. So he took us up to Fernie Creek one Sunday morning, and we actually know the date. It's in a diary, but it's in 1958, the first time we went to Falls Creek, Fernie Creek. We started running there, and when Ron joined us, we all started going up there. And actually, in Ron's book, there's a chapter called the Fernie Creek Gang.
Yeah.
And that gives a really good coverage of what happened up at Fernie Creek. And so all our running was between Caulfield Racecourse, Fernie Creek, but we did... There were no synthetic tracks or, you know, there was only one athletic track around. That was Olympic Park. We used to do all our track work in spikes on Caulfield Racecourse. And then we'd go to Fernie Creek every Sunday, and we had our established runs at Fernie. And we did those, and more people came. But in the early days, there was only four or five of us. We used to stay at Frank's house, and we'd park out the front. And then eventually the numbers started to improve, so we moved up the street to the Corroboree store, which was maybe 100 metres. There was a bit of car parking. And then numbers increased even more. And then nowadays, you know, there's people fill out the car park up at, up in Sherbrooke Forest. So it's really grown from there. But that made a big difference to us. And we worked off each other. We didn't have a coach, but... we trained together and we exchanged ideas, and basically we learned from others. We're aware of Percy Serity, but we didn't. In his earlier days, Ron had been coached by Franz Stampfel, who was based up at Melbourne University, and Franz coached Ralph Dubell later, but Merv Lincoln in his early days, who competed in the 56 and 60 Olympics. But we're aware of Franz's training, and before I met Ron, so late 50s, I had a copy of Franz Stampfel's book, and he had training schedules in the back. It was basically tracks, and that was basically what Franz did. It was a lot of repetition, 200s, 400s, all that sort of thing. And I actually, in my copy of the book, and I've still got it, I had in pencil, he'd write down 10 by 4, 40, it was yards, 75 seconds, and I'd had in pencil what I actually wrote, so it might have been a bit slower, but I wrote down, and that was what I followed, so... And he was one of my first, well, sort of influences a bit, I suppose. And then Frank helped us. We discovered Serity. And then in early 1961, a Victorian team went over to compete in New Zealand. And we competed in three different places in the North Island. And in the last race, we competed in Auckland in a cross-country race at the race course. And the Victorian team consisted of myself and Tony Cook and Rod Bonella, who I mentioned earlier, and a few others. And the New Zealand, or the Auckland team, it was only the Auckland team, but that had Murray Helberg, Barry McGee, both Olympic medalists, Bill Bailey, and quite a few others. So it was a really strong team, and I think I finished fourth in the race, but Bailey, Helberg and McGee were all ahead of me, but I've got a picture of me. I'm in the same picture at that stage, but it was early in the race. Then at the same time, we met their coach, Arthur Lydiard. And so whilst Lydiard didn't coach us, we talked to him about his training, and he listened to what we were doing. And basically, we were doing the same sort of thing. We'd worked it out ourselves. We were doing a combination of running in the hills, which he did. They had a weekly run around the Waitakere Ranges. And we'd do that. We used to run up to, well, we built it up, but at Fernie Creek on Sundays, we had courses that varied between probably about an hour and a half and 2.5 hours. And the longest one was we called it the 22-mile circuit. There was a round through the hills and mountains at Ferny Creek. Interesting thing that happened after that was that when people turned up with their Garmins and stuff, they'd tell us, now that wasn't 22 miles, you know, but it was what our estimate, you know, we called it the 22 mile circuit. It was, and in these days, if you're going for a 20 kilometre run, people just were a 2 hour run, they'd actually keep going for an extra 2 minutes. Get back too early, they'd have to run for another couple of minutes.
I've done a few blockies around here.
Yeah, well, I don't believe in that. We always believed in running the, we had several courses, say the 22 mile, 17 mile, and we'd run those. And if we got back early or got back late, it just gave us an indication of how we were going. So,
did you used to do those fast TV? Sorry to interrupt, but I'm always, yeah, like, were you guys racing each other on those Sunday long runs? Because you hear conflicting messages.
We didn't race each other, but we didn't certainly jog around. We'd build up. The runs on the race course were fairly fast. And later on, when Derek Clayton started running with us, and that was probably about 1964, Derek started running, and it was a hell of a job to try and run with Derek and Ron when they got together, because they didn't race each other, but they went hard. But Ferny Creek, there were a few places there. We'd mainly run together, and we'd sort of regroup. But the early parts of the run we did normally, you'd start at Ferny Creek and then go down sort of to Sassafras and then all the way down to Callista. And then from there was a hill called the 2 Mile Hill that we used to run. And that was, we'd run up that very strongly, and we'd have new people join us, and they'd want to know where the top was, you know. So, but we did that, and then from further on, approaching the 2 Mile Hill, there was an area that you run through a couple of forest paths, and we used to take it in turns, like a catch-me-if-you-can thing. So it might be my turn, so I'd go to the front and just try and run those guys off their feet. We used to do that a little bit around the botanical gardens in the city. There was a small area there in the middle of the gardens that had a windy path running around through it, and we'd take it in turns to run to lead there. And then you'd regroup at the finish. We didn't have to wait long for the others. But, it was, the pace was, it wasn't racing. We didn't race each other, but we helped each other. And we discussed afterwards how we'd went or how we felt or how we can improve things. That's sort of the way it went.
Do you credit you guys being so good because you spent so long on the soft surfaces as well? Like, it sounds like you never ran on a cement footpath or a bitumen road.
Very rarely. In winter, we'd run in shoes, but quite often on the race course, we'd run barefoot. One person who rarely ran barefoot was Ron, because he was susceptible to bee stings, and so was his brother Jack. Jack, a lot of you would know, he was an Essendon footballer and coach. Jack was quite a good runner, but he was probably a better footballer. But they both suffered. If bees bit them, they swelled right up, so Ron rarely ran barefoot, but they didn't bother me, so I was able to do it. And I enjoyed running barefoot. I never raced barefoot. Oh, I did a couple of maybe once or twice.
Cross country?
Yeah, cross country. There's a course up out of Ballarat round Lake Burrumbeet. That's right. There was a cross country race there, and we used to run barefoot.
Chaz Saffron? Was it called the Chaz Saffron then? Yeah, through the Pine Forest?
Yeah,
I know
up at Burrumbeet.
Yep. Finish on that race course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a really rough race course, that.
Well, it's another race similar to the Eagle Hawk to Bendigo that probably held a bit of prestige, and now it's kind of dropped off a bit. And, yeah, I'm not sure if they still – I think they do, because I think Julian actually won it last year, my co-host, in Ballarat, yeah.
Yeah, no, well, in those days, the Eagle Hawk to Bendigo and the Charles Saffron, there were a lot of Melbourne runners used to go up there, but I don't think they do now. Yeah. But, so barefoot wasn't a high priority, but in those days, a lot did run barefoot. I mentioned Dave Stevens before, who broke the world record for 6 mile. I may be wrong, but it might have been that race, but I think Dave ran barefoot then. You could do it in those days because you were running on cinder tracks or grass, and it was a little bit easier on your feet. But there's been others that have run in more recent times that used to run barefoot quite a lot. English runner Bruce Tallow. He ran barefoot and ran a sub-4-minute mile in barefoot, I think, in New Zealand. I'm not sure. But Tallow ran barefoot.
Zola Budd, she was barefoot for a while there, yeah.
Yeah, Zola. I saw her. I was manager of the Australian team in the World Cross Country Championships in Lisbon in 1985, and Zola ran there, and she won, and she ran barefoot. That was quite an experience to see her run, because we all knew of Zola Budd. And then she, the problem she had, and she finished up running for England so she could get in the Olympics. And then she had a famous incident with Mary Decker. Anyone knows that? But anyhow, go on with some of those things. But barefoot was, a lot of people ran barefoot in those days. When I ran, you're running steeple, you couldn't run barefoot. In fact, to run the steeple, you needed spikes, and there were spikes you could get for steeple that actually had a couple of spikes on the ball of your foot or just up past the ball so you wouldn't slip off the water jump. And they were quite long spikes, so if you hit the top of the water jump with your spikes, because it was a grass track, you'd be in all sorts of trouble. I'll give you an instance of slipping on the water jump. I raced a few times in Dunedin in New Zealand, and it was in Dunedin that I ran my personal best mile. You said it was 4:01, but it was 4:01.7.
Okay. We'll get to that mile later on. So I think there's a
I ran down there, and I they wanted me to have a go at the steeple because the New Zealand record was, I think, 8:52 or something like that. I'm not sure, but it wasn't. No, it was a bit like Australia. When I attempted the Australian record for the steeple, it was 8:50, and that was set by Neil Robbins in the 56 Olympics. And I got it down to 8:39, but New Zealand was the same. The New Zealand record was fairly slow, and I'd already run it low 8:40s in Australia, so they asked me to have a go at the New Zealand record. But when it was in Dunedin, they had no water jump. It was a bitumen track, and there was no water jump, so they dug a water jump, and I've got a photo of the pile of dirt beside the water jump. We actually had to run off the bitumen onto the grass and then over the water jump and then the loop around, then you got back on the bitumen again. So it was a bit different. So I wasn't able to wear long spikes for the water jump because I had to run on bitumen, so I had very short spikes. I was maybe after the first couple of laps, so I slipped on the top of the water jump and went head first into the water. And I've got a photo of me just with my head poking out. And I got up and continued, and I still ran about 8:48 and broke the New Zealand record. So,
not a bad day out.
I went back a few times later and knocked it down to about 8:41, I think. Sadly, some of my times still would have, in fact, this year I think I probably still would have won the national title. I don't know.
I wanted to get there later on, but when you see the current state of athletics like that, what are your feelings around it? I just want to make some points, slower track and our technology's improved so much and our nutrition and, what are your thoughts when you see results like that?
When I see the world record times now compared to what they were then and the athletes that are involved, I can't have it that these current athletes are any better than Zatopek or... certainly Ron Clark. Ron knocked 34 seconds off the world record for 10,000 metres. He brought it down from 28:14 to 27:39. And no one just imagined that that could happen. And now it's down to 26:20, is it, or something like that. It's a minute faster than Ron Clark ran, over a minute, and I just can't have it that those people are any better than Ron Clark, but I still can't have it probably that Ron Clark was any better than Zatopek. They were all great in their era because Zatopek was the first person to break 29 minutes for 10K and Clarkie took it down to 27.5 minutes. And it was due to a range of things. I mean, it's like the four-minute mile. People think that's, four-minute mile. Everyone does it. But in those days, it was like a mental barrier. And you didn't, I think people trained as hard in those days, but the goals weren't as high. And I think that... if you got Ron Clark and Zatopek and Vladimir Kutz and Lassie Viren and the current world record holders together, I wouldn't want to bet on who'd win it. And that's the same in a lot of events.
Take me back to training. Mileage, did you keep a diary of how many Ks you were doing, or miles you were doing a week? What did a weekly structure look like? We know the kind of traditional training at the moment in Australia. What did it look like then?
Roughly the same sort of thing that we advocate now. We'd run up to 100 mile a week, so about that was mine. My maximum was probably around 100 miles, so that's about 160k a week. And based on that training and the training I did, I still was able to run 4:01 for a mile and probably could have run faster if I... Oh, I was going to mention the steeplechase. When Ron Clark turned up, it didn't take me long to realise that this guy was going to be able to, you know, could handle me on the track, unless I sat on him and he made a mistake, which happened a few times. So very early in my career, I found that I was able to hurdle and had good flexibility. So Ron was one of the reasons that I took up the steeple to keep away from him. In early 60s, they had the Victorian 5 mile, 8K cross country down at Warrigal. And Tony Cook and myself and Ron warmed up round the course, and it was through creeks and over fences and all that sort of stuff. And as we were going round, those two would lag behind, and as we go through a gate, over a gate, they'd go back and open the gate. So I'd go back and close it, you know, so I could get the edge on those guys over the jump. So, yeah, I kept away from Ron as often as, well, by running steeple. And that was very early in the piece. I picked that pretty well because although in 1964, when sometimes he made the occasional mistake, and then the 1965 Australian Championships, Albie Thomas beat me in the mile after I led in the straight, and then Clarkie won the 6 mile, so he'd done a bit more than I had. Next day was the Australian 3 mile championship, and they both messed around and just raced each other, and then I outsprinted them both. So I
gave you a sniff.
Yeah. Gave me a sniff, and I managed to win the Australian 3 mile championship and beat Albie and Dave and Ron, who both held the world record for 3 miles. But that was a rare occasion, I've got to say. It was a bit more likely to handle Ron at a mile than anything further.
Take me out. Talk us about that 4:01.7 mile. Bit of regret there?
Not really. That was around the time, I'm not sure if it's the same year that I ran that steeple there, but Ron and I went over and... I think we both ran the mile, and the guy who won the mile was John Davies, who, this was early 64. John went on then to win bronze in Tokyo behind Peter Snell. But John hadn't broken 4 minutes, and I think my best time was about 4:07 or 4:08. And Ron had run 4:06 as a junior. But we got in there, and I think my recollection is that we'd decided that I'd take the first lap, Ron would take the second lap, John Davies would take the third lap, and then it was whoever was left could take it over. But I was very lucky. The first lap, one of the other guys in the field didn't realise that had happened, so he went out and ran 57 seconds for the first lap. So I thought, I'm not going to do anything there. So I just hung back, and then Ron took his lap, and then John did. It was on a bitumen track in Dunedin. And then... it's a good race, and the three, well, particularly John and I, were together turning in the straight, and John went away a bit and ran 4:00.9, and I ran 4:01.7, and Ron ran 4:03. And I've said afterwards that I would have liked to have had a chance to have a go at a four-minute mile, but steeple took precedence, and so when there'd be a major meet on, I'd run the steeple rather than the mile, and I'd do... technique training for the steeple rather. I still maintained a bit of speed, so I won the Victorian Mile Championship right through to 65 and finished second in the Australian up to 65 or even 66. I was going to, as far as steeplechase training is concerned, because I always believed that to run a steeple, to some extent, I like to train steeple training when I was a bit tired, because I get a bit of argument from other athletes, particularly sprinters, but I call the steeple the toughest event on the distance running program. 400 runners argue with me, but they reckon that 400's harder, but anyhow they... But we used to go to Ferny Creek on Sundays, and we'd do our 22-mile run-up at Ferny Creek on Sundays, and then I'd go and do track work down at Mentone Track and do my steeple training there, because it just took the edge off me a little bit, and I felt that benefited me when I ran steeples. That I was used to being a little bit tired. Yeah,
I've only run the one, and it was like a AV shield day when you've got to do as many events as possible to get as many points for your club as possible. And yeah, it wasn't a fun day. It's got to be much tougher than the 400. The 400 is over in like 50 seconds for those guys.
You try and tell that to a 400 runner.
Sprinters love themselves, yeah. full of themselves sprinters.
There's been some discussion on that recently, and when I talk about that Facebook page and mine, I put something on there and called it the toughest event on the athletic program, and a couple of 400 runners who I permitted to be follow this Facebook page. You're supposed to be distance runners. But they said, oh, you know, there's nothing like a 400. You're nearly dying at the finish and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But anyhow, no, I can't come at it. Yeah.
In the steeple now, take me back to 1962, that gold medal day. Did you go in the favourite or were you pretty confident?
I was reasonably confident. The only opposition, I'd run fairly quickly. I'd run low 840s. The main opposition was a guy named Maurice Herriot from England, who actually went on later to get second in Tokyo in the steeple, much to my envy. But it turned out a little bit in my favour because the day of the steeple in Perth was 37 degrees, so 103, I think. Maurice wasn't quite used to that sort of weather.
English bloke.
But it was very hot. And I just went in there and ran my normal race. And I believe that in a steeple, there's various tactics. I argue that if someone wants to get in a race and lead, they've got to do it for a purpose. And you quite often see people get out there and just run their worst race because they go and lead when they don't need to, and they've got no reason for doing it. They say, oh, I was trying to run my best time. You know, I tried to run a PB, but you're not going to run a PB from the front, very rarely. I always believed if I felt that I could handle it, that I like to lead in a steeple because I get a better sight of the obstacles. And I'd always, you know, still run my own race from the front. But after a few laps in Perth, I decided that probably only with about three laps to go, I decided to go to the front, and Herriot came with me. And then I just managed to hold him off. So that's my main recollection there. But it was unexpected by me, but I suppose that it was either out of the two of us, and Australia had four representatives in the Commonwealth Games in those days in each event, and we got first, third, fourth, and about seventh, so we ranked pretty well there. But there weren't a lot of, there were no Africans then, but if there had been Africans there, I'm sure I would have handled them. But, there was a Ugandan, I think, and there was a picture of this Ugandan guy being carried off the track on a stretcher. So maybe the Africans didn't handle the hot weather quite so well. Yep.
Were you running a bit scared, though? Like you hit the front, three laps to go. It was only 2 seconds in the end. Like, what was going through your head when you go? Because the steeplechase is so unpredictable.
I felt confident that I had enough there, and I felt strong at the end. And if there is film around, and 2 seconds is actually a fair margin. I think probably about 15 metres or something. So I was well clear. I got it clear down the back straight and managed to hold him off. I did have a bit of a, not a stumble, but at the last water jump, I sort of, my knees almost buckled a bit. I managed to keep going. But I don't want to get onto this now, but one of my problems, or the problem that I had soon after that, was with my Achilles. I had Achilles tendon trouble. Certainly in 1964, I backed off steeples a little bit because I was having a little bit of Achilles soreness. But anyhow, in 64, I got back into them and I ran 8:39, or 8:38.9 actually.
Sammy McLean, I'm going to have to get him, get onto him about these notes.
While you're telling him, he said four Australian titles. So there were four steeple titles plus a mile and a 3 mile. So there's six Australia titles.
I'll email him tomorrow, TV.
Leading into Tokyo, I ran 8:39. And then we had a training camp up in Sydney for 2 weeks before we went to the Games. And my Achilles flared up there. I was still running very well. And I won a mile race on the Sydney cricket ground, beat Ron and Albie in about 4:04 or 4:05 in a mile, but I was in trouble with my Achilles. And so when we got to Tokyo, the team doctor said that if I had more time, I'd give you a cortisone injection, because I actually got a bursitis in my heel, so I had a bit of swelling on the heel. And when I was training up in Sydney prior to the Games, I actually had to use one of Tony Cook's shoes on my right foot with a padding there to ease my Achilles a bit. So I didn't run well there. I ran 8:58 and was run out. And Herriot, who I'd beaten in Perth, came out and won the silver medal and went close to catching Gaston Rolance, who won the race. But then I wouldn't mind talking about Tokyo, some of the experiences there if we've got time. But then when we came back from Tokyo, almost immediately I had a cortisone injection, and that fixed it temporarily. It snapped in 1966, but it lasted me a couple more years. An American guy who'd run in the final in Tokyo came out here, and I beat him in the race in Melbourne. That just was bad timing. Can I talk a little bit about Tokyo?
Talk about... Oh, first, can we just get Commonwealth Games for a minute, then we'll move on to Tokyo. But I know you you had your first... Well, you didn't have your first child, but you became a father that same year, 1962, correct?
That's right.
You're working full-time at this stage? Like, does life even change when you win a gold medal at the Commonwealth Game? Or is it back to work? You're not,
to go back to work.
You're not signing $1 million sponsorship deal and a full-time athlete?
No sponsors then. I think before Tokyo, Ron had met Addy Dassler, who was the guy behind Adidas. And I've got a note from Dassler saying that we're sending in the mail to you a couple of pairs of shoes and a bag and a pair of shoes for your coach. And there was a guy helping with steeplechase named Theo Raybong, and they sent Theo a pair of flats, but he wasn't a runner. But that was all the sponsorship I got. I got... Adidas gave us a pair of shoes, and then we had to buy them. There was nothing, no local ones. And then I discovered what are now ASICS, and they had a sort of a shoe that we found comfortable. Something I was going to mention about shoes is when Dave Stevens started running with us at Caulfield Racecourse, he decided to try and make... He'd made the 56 team but didn't run well. He wanted to try and make it to 60. He talked me into running the King of the Mountains, Melbourne Victorian Marathon Club, King of the Mountains. And he said he'd discovered the perfect shoe. He said, you wear slippers, they're really comfortable. You just wear slippers and you put a bit of elastic across the top just to hold them in place. So we both ran the King of the Mountains race in slippers. We got up the top all right, but when we started to run down the hill, there's no way, you know, because you just slipped inside the slippers. Yeah. And so we both didn't make it down the hill. So that was... you had to experiment with your own shoes in those days.
Okay, now we can move on to Tokyo.
Oh, well, I've got some incredible experiences of Tokyo. I don't know where to start, but of course, you know, I'd had a lot to do with Peter Snell and Murray Helberg, who I knew quite well. And Peter, early in 1964, I mentioned this before, I'm not sure, but I went over and raced. John Davies set up a race in his hometown of Tokoroa. He set up a mile race there and a few others, and I went over to run in the mile. And Snell and Davies were in the same race, and it was run on a grass track, and as it turned out, the night it was pouring rain. And John, being the hometown man, and he was in great shape, he got out and ran from the front, ran 4:01 in incredible conditions. And Snell, I was with Peter Snell coming into the straight, and he ran 4:07 and I ran 4:08, which I was reasonably happy with. But then who would have dreamt that within 6 months Peter went to Tokyo? He was just like that. He's a big guy. And they had that, the way they trained, they had the periodisation. And when Peter got to Tokyo, he was just absolutely unbeatable. He won the 800 and the 1500 and just absolutely blew them away. So that was a great memory, and knowing those guys. Of course, the 10K in Tokyo with Ron Clark and Billy Mills and Mohammed Gamoudi, I was in the stand watching that. Of course, I had plenty of time. I was eliminated on day one, so I was able to watch the rest of the races. That was a great race. And then Ron, he was very disappointed with that, but then in the 5,000 metres, he won his heat. And then in the final, I was actually sitting in the turn in the straight with his wife, Helen, and he knew where we were sitting. And in the final, it was very slow. No one was prepared to lead. And I think Ron decided that he wasn't going to push it too hard. And then after about halfway through the race, he looked across to where we were sitting and he just sort of rolled his eyes. And I think he realised then he was in real trouble. In that race, another American who we'd never heard of before afterwards, Bob Shull, he won the 5K and Ron finished about sixth. So that was another great memory from there. And the other, well, amongst the other great memories from Tokyo was Abebe Bikila in the marathon, who I remembered well from Rome. And there's some great film of him running in Rome down the Appian Way in the dark. It's just unbelievable. And he stopped and touched his toes and did all exercises at the finish. Well, he did that the same in Tokyo. And Ron and... Oh, I was going to say, as far as the... I got close to running an Olympic marathon. In those days, if you if the places weren't, the spots in an event weren't full, another one who's in the team could apply to fill the spot. And so Bob Vagg was the only one selected. He won the trial. And then myself, Tony Cook, Albie Thomas, and Ron Clark all applied for the other two spots. So I got that close. I've got a letter saying that, sorry to have to tell you, but Ron Clark and Tony Cook have got the other two spots in the marathon. So Albie and I missed out. But there's some great film of that race too. And Abubu Keeler once again was absolutely unbeatable. And he'd run 2:15 in Rome, and then he ran 2:12 in Tokyo. He was an absolutely unbelievable athlete. And then he, as you probably know, he competed in 68, and then he was in a car accident soon after that and became a paraplegic and died probably in his early 40s. But I had incredible memories of him. And the other person I remember well, or two, in the women's 400, I mentioned before that Betty Cuthbert, I'd watched her in Melbourne in 56, but in 64 she won the 400. And third in that was a really good friend of mine who's actually coming with me up to the Commonwealth Games this year, Judy Pollock. And Judy finished third in the 400. So we had Australia got first and third in the women's 400. And that was probably the first women's 400 at the Olympics. I'm not sure about that. I know that in 1960, an Australian friend of mine, Brenda Carr, got second. She got the silver medal in Rome in 1960 in the 880 or the 800 metres. And that was they'd had a women's 800 in maybe 1932, and that's the only time it had been held before, and they decided that it was women couldn't handle 800s, so they dropped it. And the longest distance in Melbourne in 56 was a 200 for women, and then they introduced an 800 in Rome that Brenda got second in, and then they added in the 400 in Tokyo. And then it went on from there, 1,500. And they even decided they can run a marathon. So, you know, that's the way it works out.
After you missed not getting that bonus spot at the Olympic marathon, did you ever go run one after that?
Yeah. I ran a few marathons. I ran, but only sort of in my later years. My best time was 2:26. But I've got a fair range. I won an Australian mile championship and 3 mile. And I've got a gold medal from the marathon.
What marathon?
The Australian. Teams race.
Yeah. Where were they held? No. Tell us about it. This stuff doesn't come up when you Google your name.
I finished fourth in the Australian Marathon Championship at Point Cook. I don't know what year it was. So that's my claim to fame. I got an Australian Championship gold medal for the marathon. But it's team race, so it depended on the others. The race was won by a guy named John Farrington from South Australia, and then a Victorian or a New Zealander, Terry Manners, who was running for Victoria at the time. He got second, and I think I was... Anyway, I made the Victorian team in the marathon.
Claim it. Hey, tell me about the tracks back then. Were they, like, so much slower than they are now, the all-weather synthetic ones?
Yeah, of course. It depended on the conditions. The tracks would be rolled, and I've got photos from Tokyo. It was a cinder track, and after all the events, they'd have people, sweepers out there sweeping the track to just fill in the holes. So it wasn't, and then they'd occasionally roll it. I think that used to happen at Olympic Park. The track used to get rolled, but on a wet day, it wasn't the place to be. I've got a few photos of races in. You know, you're running around splashing through muddy water at Olympic Park. But and to some extent, that might explain a little bit why the times are a little bit slower. But as I say, the times are really... They were times that sort of met the criteria of those days. You know, no one dreamed that you could run, 3:43 for a mile. Who would have ever dreamt you could run 3:43 for a mile when no one had broke 4 minutes, and they still thought that was impossible? And so, yeah, the tracks were different. I posted a picture on Facebook the other day of me going over a water jump, and someone asked me what was the base of the water jump in those days, and I actually couldn't remember. I thought it was dirt, but then on reflection I realised that there were actually boards under there. So you ran on a cinder track, and if you did the water jump, there were actually boards there. So you didn't land in mud, you actually landed on boards. But I like grass tracks. Enjoyed running on grass, and Peter Snell ran a world record for 800 metres on grass, which might still be the New Zealand record. I'm not sure, but he ran 144 point something on grass in New Zealand. And there's been lots of subsequently, you know, quite a few sub-four-minute miles on grass. And as I said, John Davies, when I was running there, ran 400.9 for a mile in pouring rain on a grass, thick, you know, heavy grass track. So, but these days things are quite different. But I don't think bitumen tracks, the real improvement came with the synthetic tracks. But bitumen was better than dirt or grass, because you didn't need to wear such long spikes, you know, and I think that to some extent a long spikes might have impeded you a little bit.
You sound like you guys were racing every weekend, like compared to the elite guys now who we might see, you know, when they kind of hit their main racing period, maybe three or four times within 6 weeks. You raced a bit regularly.
We ran in the winter season, we'd run all the cross-country races. But we trained through them. We'd still, you know, after a race, we'd be up the hills on Sunday morning, and we talked a bit about training, but Friday was traditionally an easier day. So when we were at Caulfield Racecourse, we'd go over and maybe run maybe run 40 minutes or just run around on the grass. Then we'd go back in the club rooms and play table tennis. So that was part of our training the night before. But, we ran into club most of the time, and it was part of training. Quite often we'd double. We'd go down there. We might run something early. I don't know whether it was a 200 or, you know, I'd run a hurdles occasionally. And then we'd go out for an hour run along the beach, and then we'd come back and we'd run the 3 miles. So it wasn't, you know, they're still in my diary, but I wasn't, every race wasn't like some people now. They set themselves for each race, and if you don't run a PB, you know, you don't run a quick time, you have to do a review of what went wrong and all that sort of stuff. No, we just got out there and we raced often, and we tried to learn from our experiences, and we talked to the other guys about how they went. Ron was the same, and Tony Cook, and all those people, even Ralph Dubell, who didn't run that often, and he didn't run winter, but Ralph used to race quite often in Interclub, but not these days. But it was part of the fun. We enjoyed what we were doing, and it was, if you read Ron's book, I think you'll find that one of the things he found that benefited him when he started running with us at Caulfield Racecourse was just the comradeship and the exchanging ideas and, you know, the social atmosphere and getting out and running hard, but, you know, still learning from it. I had one of my main rivals was a Victorian named Ron Blackney, and Ron had run in the 56 Olympics in the steeple. He was being friendly about it. Before each race, he'd come out and shake hands with everyone in the field, but I dodged him, and because I knew that what had happened, as soon as the race started, he'd be cutting me off, and he'd be, you know, giving me a shove in the elbow, all that sort of thing. So, you know, that was just a bit of a facade. Yeah, he'd try and con you into thinking what a nice guy he was, and then he'd get out there and try and run you off the track.
Yeah, right. TV, I wanted to talk to you about the current state of athletes, and we kind of touched on it before, but, you know, maybe this is marathon specific, and I'm not sure if you'll have an opinion on it, but I think you've got some pretty bit of knowledge behind you. But why are the marathoners not as fast as we used to be? You know, the 207 from Deke, unofficial, and Boston, of course, and the 208 from Monner and Clayton, but our top guy's now 211. Why aren't we as quick?
As far as Australian distance running is concerned, yeah.
Yeah, don't worry about that.
That's happened a little bit around the world, and I think it's to do with the Africans to some extent, you know, to a large extent, because if you look at most of the major races, other than the Olympics and Games and that, Africans dominate it. And you'd look at a major race and you might find the top 10 are all from Ethiopia or Kenya. And that's to do with probably pacing and the money that's involved. And the money's much more enticing for the Africans. This is quite often you'll see Africans will get out there and run one or two races, get enough money, go home, and that's the last you'll see of them. Then another 10 will turn up. But quite often you'll see the major races aren't run quite as quickly because there's no pacemakers there and there's only three from each country. But there's the money's in there for fast times. And people probably, you've seen that with artificial pacing, they almost broke 2 hours for a marathon. And that's what happened a little bit with Bannister, I suppose. He had pacing. But Ron, I don't think give people the current world record for the mile, El Garouge, is it? Yeah, well, there wouldn't have been pacing then. He was out there and trying to win the races. But the nowadays, you know, the pacing makes a difference, the money that's involved, and probably there's a range of other improvements, the shoes, and they even, I think for that world record, the sub-2-hour attempt, they made special shoes for the runners in that, and they had windbreaks and you name it.
I've got two pairs of those shoes.
Eh?
Got two pairs. They've helped me a bit, but I'm nowhere near that time.
No, well, I'm not sure you're going to break 2 hours in them, mate, but yeah.
I'll take you out my secret training zone tomorrow at the industrial estate. You'll like it out there. If anyone's got to do it, they should set up a race out there. You break 2 hours out, Moama.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But back on that, though, you don't think the current state of Australian distance runners are doing anything wrong or incorrect? Because there's plenty of guys putting in the 100-mile weeks, but, the results just don't seem to come.
Yeah, to some extent, I think there's a bit of selfishness around. I'd like to see people training together more. There's some groups that, they focus on particular events, and I think that in Australia there's not the, there's not the depth. But I think that, if we just get one or two people back to running 2:10, then it'll happen. It's more just a bit of peer pressure. Derek ran 2:08.5 back in 1969, a long time ago. When it was Deke was 2 and Monner, now 20 years ago, when was the last time anyone broke 2:10 here in Australia? A long time ago.
Troopy.
Yeah, and that's still quite a long time ago. Yeah. So I think that it's just not on their radar at this stage. Somehow or other, we've just got to raise our sights a little bit, and maybe just to encourage people have a paced marathon here and tell people it's on, and then just let a few try and... I don't know how you do it, because there has to be money involved in it for them.
Mm. What about the future of athletics and track and field TV? We saw the Nitro series start. Was that last summer? I know you were down there watching that. I think I spoke to you when you were in Echuca about the week after that, last time, a week before. And where do you think the future of athletics is going?
Good question. Nitro was all right, but it didn't inspire me too much, I'm afraid. I like to see head-to-head races. I'd rather see racing than pacing. You don't see too much pacing on the track, I suppose, but most of the pacing's done out on the road. But, we're battling a little bit now. We haven't got the depth in a lot of events. And I think that, once again, I think that internationally we're intimidated by some of those other countries, particularly Africans. And we need a few more Craig Mottrams who was able to mix it with them. But need a few more examples up there of people who can get in there and mix it. And I'm not sure what will happen. The Commonwealth Games is different. We had a winner, was it last time, that Michael Shelley won the last one?
Glasgow, yep.
Yeah, and there's no reason why we can't have a winner here, but there are going to be 3 Kenyans and a number of athletes, from other African countries. So I think that we'll still get a good race, but you never know what might happen. Who would have thought that Michael Shelley would win? But if that can happen, it might raise the profile a little bit. But, I think it's still a battle now to try and get more people involved. And with the attractions, even now, the women, it's hard to get women because they're all playing AFL football. So, we've just got to try and make the thing more attractive and give more incentive, maybe hold a couple of, try and help, not so much getting too much deliberate pacing, but try and, like in a marathon there, you see the sign up that says, if you want to run 2:30, you get behind a guy with a sign. So we just need someone with a sign that says 2:05 and see how many can go the way with him.
I want to finish with the TV of now. What are you doing in the terms of athletics now? And talk us through your Facebook page, because you're telling me that, you've got quite a few thousand people who follow your progress.
I'm a bit of a nut on athletics history and distance running in particular, and I can match your library quite easily.
Yeah,
you're working on it, I know.
Yeah,
but I've got a large collection of athletics memorabilia, and included, I mentioned to you before, I've got Edwin Flack's autograph, which hardly anyone's got. In fact, I think it's priceless. I've got it with me if anyone wants to have a look.
It's
but,
in the bag, yeah.
I got that, I won't say where from, but I've got a fair bit of Flack memorabilia, and I've done a tour of Berwick and been to his grave, you know, so I'm a bit of a fan there. And that's tied in a little bit with my work as a volunteer guide at the MCG, at the Sports Museum. So if anyone wants, people come in and want to ask questions about sport, if they want to know something about Australian rules football, they don't ask me. But if they want to know something about athletics, well, then I can help them with that. And I followed for a while, I was following an English Facebook site called I Was or Am a Runner. And that covered a range of athletics events, and it was current stuff, and it was even had walks, you know, no walkers here, but it had, you know, all these Mickey Mouse sports, you know, jumps and throws. And I thought, well, I wouldn't mind getting something happening here that covers distance running only. So I called it Australian Distance Running Nostalgia, and I started that about 12 months ago, and have now got probably 1,500 followers. And I just try, one of my idea with that is to try and educate people about distance running and not just current. And if something gets posted that's not related to distance running, if you post something about the walk, I might give you one threat of warning and then you're off the list. So that's been, it's got a lot of followers and it's very popular, and I'm getting people that are sending me material, and I'm trying to encourage them to post it themselves. I'm still involved in coaching, and one of the persons I've helped over the last few years is here tonight, Tali Bird. And Tali's, you know, we've been really proud of what she's achieved. Australian Championship at the Marathon, represent Australia and done a whole range of things. There's still more to come, we hope. But I first met Tali, I think, at Monash Uni when I was, I've got a running squad at Monash Uni, Clayton campus, and Tali was a student there. So I'm still involved there. I've got a large squad there, and I was away last night, but my mate Len Johnson, who's my sidekick there, Len tells me there were 85 there last night. So it's a pretty big group at Monash. And I'm still involved at the club. I work in partnership sort of with another coach, Leslie Grimes, and Leslie's spot on with her training, and, you know, we work as a team and help people. And that's worked out really well. My other involvements include, I'm on the Committee of Athletics International, which is a sort of an elite group, but we provide funding and sponsorships, scholarships from a trust fund we've got for aspiring athletes to help them, you know, in their development. We have a Ron Clark scholarship that's worth $5,000 each year, and we have two Steve Malaghetti Awards, the Emerging Athlete Awards for male and female, and I'm on the selection committee for those. So a lot of other involvements as well.
Leave us with a piece of advice. You know the sport better than just about anyone in Australia, I think, and the people in front of you here, I'm just looking around, there's some, Archie's just ran 15:23 last week at the Vic Championships, and we've got a few marathoners and a big range here, but also for the listeners at home, what's one bit of advice with their training or nutrition or race strategy that you think you could pass on to the listeners?
All right, okay. Well, I think that, you know, there's a quote that I like, that you've got an hour, if something bad goes wrong in your race, you've got an hour to dwell on it, and then you move on. So you don't dwell on things of the past, you try and learn from what's happened. I think that, you know, you've got to have a proper structure in your training and try and do it regularly. If you're a distance runner, I think you asked before about the structure. The sort of structure we like is really, is probably 7 days, but 6 days at least running, and once or twice a day. But the main run of each, just broadly, would be a long run on Sunday, and that depends on what your ambitions are and whether you're a marathon runner or middle distance. But I still think distance runners, probably from 1,500 up, still need to do a long run each week, a medium long run midweek, and then fartlek type session, track session, and a range of other. Amongst those fartlek sessions, you include stuff like monofartlek and straights, 400s, you know, a range of other things. And then on the track, we'd do something faster in spikes. And the other days are easier. Not so long, but including, you know, acceleration runs, a range of other little things. But you try and keep the structure up. Keep a diary. I'd like to have someone that keeps a diary one way. In the old days, a handwritten diary was a lot easier to follow than Strava, but, you know, you've got to go with the times. You can't get the same information out of that, but it still works okay. So I like to people to keep a diary, run with other people, reasonable surface like we did, not on the road and bitumen too much, because it can. Some people run on the roads and bitumen all the time, and they seem to handle it, but I really think that one of the things that helped us was running at Fernie Creek and running on grass, because it actually strengthened up your ankles and knees, what I liked about running in the Dandenongs was just the twisting and turning. Not twisting too much, you actually twist your ankle, but you know, you learn the tracks and you learn how to run. You can accelerate out of corners. You can do a range of little drills just by doing a run in the forest that you can't do anywhere else.
Beautiful. TV, we could sit here all night, Norma. I'm just conscious that some people have travelled and they've got to get home and stuff, but we can definitely do a part two next time you're in Chukamauama. But thanks again for your time. Any audience members got a quick question that they want? I've got a million other questions down here written down that we could get to, but does anyone have something pressing?
I've just got something to add that
go for it.
I was approached when I arrived by a former Glen Huntly member who still had his Glen Huntly singlet with him. So I was very impressed with that, Jeff. Yeah. And we've got a photo of that, so it might appear on the Glen Huntly Facebook page or the website.
Anyone from the audience got a question for TV?
Can I just ask, in my drawer at work is an article written in 1995 by Ron Clark, and it was in reference to some comments made by, I think I'm right in saying, Dick Telford, talking about your group back in the day, back in the 60s, the long, slow runs, and Ron was obviously a bit put out with that comment. And just again, talking about the training, I think you mentioned it before, he's basically saying they were doing pretty much 16, 18 to 20 Ks a night on the race course, pretty much what these days we call acceleration runs, essentially, and your Fernie Creek runs. But what fascinates me, and I still pick it up each week and read it, in the article, he says at that time there were five in the group that were running sub 13:34 5K.
Yeah.
There were four in the group that ran sub 14 minutes, and that didn't include Derek Clayton, who was a world record holder for the marathon at the time. And I think the other one was Kerry O'Brien, who was a world record holder in the steeple at the time. So something tells me the training of that day had something pretty special going for it. And his main comment on the whole thing was that are we talking about strength or are we talking about speed? Because he's watched all these speed sessions for years and years and years, and he's yet to see anybody been able to get anywhere near the time. I think the only one of recent times has been Craig Mottram. I think there's nobody in the country now who can currently run sub 13:30 for 5K, which is pretty damning given this was back in the late 60s.
Yeah.
So it's just a really interesting article that I find just fascinating.
Yeah, it's a lot of Ron's writing's worth reading. He's written some great articles. As I said before, in our group there were good races on the track, and there were good races in training. And quite often we'd be beaten, but you know, someone would be ahead of us all the way. But they'd never beat us in a race. But they still ran very well, and I think it helped them to raise their own standards. And it wasn't just an elite group. We'd go to Fernie Creek. At Caulfield Racecourse, it was basically my club, but a few others, quite Sandringham and a few others ran there. But when we go to Fernie Creek, there's guys from St. Stephen's and smaller groups, but always, and that's where Deke and Tim O'Shaughnessy and those young guys, they were influenced by Pat Clohessy, but he got them to Fernie Creek. But people weren't going up there then, but we ran as groups, and if you could run along with Ron Clark and others, it raised your confidence a little bit, even though probably he wasn't going quite as hard as we were. one of the favourite runs at Fernie Creek was out of Belgrave. There's a hill that we called, you know, the Terry's Hill. A really steep hill. And after he retired from athletics, Herb Elliott came up and ran with us a few times at Fernie, and he had to walk at the top. And we actually had Dave Power from New South Wales, and Dave made it to the top with us. But and he was an Olympic bronze medalist, but he wasn't. We were used to running up there. We knew where the finish was, but he dropped off towards the finish. But, yeah, there was a real depth in there, and there's an exchange of ideas, and everyone benefited from it.
Tough as nails.
Mm.
Any other questions?
Thanks for that.
Beautiful. Thanks for coming. TV's got a whole bag of goods here if you want to witness firsthand his gold medals or some of his memorabilia. And, yeah, thanks for coming along and giving up your Wednesday night to be in the audience.
Oh, no worries, mate. It's a pleasure to be in Echuca and Moama.
Yeah, Moama tonight, and yeah.
And Pyramid Hill.
Pyramid Hill.